Blog Talk Radio.
No.
kind of money, like back in the old days. You know, years ago, they had the A&R men to tell you what to play, how to play it, you know, whether it's disco or rock. But we just went in the studio and we did it. We had champagne in the studio, of course, you know, compliments of the company, and we just laid back and did it. So we hope you enjoy listening to this album half as much as we enjoy playing it for you, because we had a ball. Only real music's gonna last. All that other bullshit is here today and gone tomorrow.
Talking women and vino. The contract like 91 Dan Marino. I swear this guy Michael Rapino's boosting my ego. Overly focused, it's far from the time to rest now. Debates growing about who they think is the best now. Took a while, got the jokers out of the deck now. I'm holding all the cards and niggas wanna play chess now. I hear you talking, say it twice so I know you meant it. Fuck it, I don't even tend it, they should know who's in it. I'm authentic, real name, no gimmicks, no game, no scrimmage. I ain't playing with you niggas at all. My classmates, they went on to be chartered accountants or work with their parents. But thinking back on how they treated me, my high school reunion might be worth an appearance. Make everybody have to go through security clearance. Tables turn, bridges burn, you live and learn. With the ink, I could murder word of my nigga Irv. Yeah, I swear shit just started clicking, dog. You know it's real when you are who you think you are.
Everything around me.
I had Benzes, but you had braces. The all black Maybach, but I'm not a racist. Inside's white in the Katy Perry's faces. Yellow diamonds in my Jesus. I just might learn to speak Mandarin. Japanese for the yen that I'm handling. International hoe, that's my handle. My Saint Chong gone, light a candle. El Gran Santo on the mantle. Case y'all didn't know, I speak Spanish too. Shout out the World Wide West. Everywhere we go, we leave a worldwide mess. Yes, still rock La Familia. Says a lot about you if you're not feeling us. The homie said, hove, it ain't many of us. I told him less is more, niggas, plenty of us.
Jazz through everything around me. Free. Get the money, dollar bill, y'all.
Cake, 500 million, I got a pound cake. Niggas is frontin', that's upside down cake. Get them a red nose, they clown cake. I should've never let you round cake. Look at my neck, I got a carrot cake. Now here's the icing on the cake. Cake. I'm just getting started, oh yeah, we got it, bitch. I done made more millionaires than Lotto did. Dame made millions, Big made millions. Ye made millions, Just made millions. Lior made millions, Cam made millions. Beans will tell you if he wasn't in the ceiling. I'm back in my bag. My eyes bloodshot, but my jet don't lag. A pair of Jordan 3's trying to chase this cab. Gucci airbag just in case we crash. Last night was mad trill. I'm fresh out of Advil, Jesus rather will.
Put your cups in the air, I might make a toast. In case it go down, yeah, you know I got my toast. doing the jacking, or you getting jacked? Or you the one that's going hard, or you falling back? And I don't believe in falling back, bitch, I'm going hard. They wanna see me fucked up, man, I swear to God. They praying that I fail, I'm praying that I rise. I guess they hating getting worse, so now they telling lies. Oh, he ain't did this, and he ain't did that. Boy, keep it real with yourself, you know he did that. You ain't real, you don't get on what they asking for. Such a real nigga, what the fuck you asking for?
Man, this young nigga killing about nothing. Show up at the spot with the choppers like nothing. Fool 50 shots, clear the block like nothing. If you made it from the bottom to the top like nothing, you don't owe a nigga nothing. Nothing. You don't owe a nigga nothing. You don't owe a nigga.
And you don't even know a nigga what you hate for. And I ain't going nowhere, so what you wait for? Beat the street, it's rap shit, cake and ice cream. Fuckin' selling words, bitch, I sold ice cream. From the bottom to the top, that's a nice ring. How you make it out, young? I had a nice game. And I don't owe a nigga shit, better get it right. Snow a nigga stay down each and every night. Hands on, yeah, I broke down my own thing. Hands on, yeah, I counted up my own change. 50's over here, 20's over there. You know the rest, nigga, bottom single there, man.
Young nigga, no. Killing about nothing.
No.
Show up at the spot, boom. Choppers like nothing.
Boom.
Fool 50 shots, no. The block like nothing.
No.
If you made it from the bottom to the top like nothing.
You don't owe a nigga
nothing. Nothing.
You don't owe a nigga
nothing. Nothing.
You don't owe a nigga.
Yeah. Yeah. Go.
You know very well.
I'm not afraid to
gonna be hard for me. I know that's where you are, things that I'm where you are. When trying to let go of you, but I don't really know if I can do it. Close the door around you. You don't really wanna see me do it, no. I tried a thousand times, told my heart a thousand lies. You won't let me say goodbye.
You don't wanna see me do it.
I got pieces. Oh no, no, no. I don't got pieces. Oh no, no, no. If you can't give me up your love, I don't want your love. No, no. If you can't give me up your love,
numbers 424-222-5250, 424-222-5250. That's the call in number. If you have a question today, get in early and press 1, and you will be placed in queue. That way I'll be able to identify whether you have a question and be able to call on you to offer your question. We're going to get the show started here in about 2 or 3 minutes. We got a great bit of callers already on the line. I hope everybody had a very productive week. Of course, the show is about debt collection, the debt collector, alleged creditors, lenders, mortgagees, pretender lenders, and whatever other affectionate term they are styled by. So get in the queue, 424-222-5250 and press 1 so you can be at the top of the line for your questions.
We need time just to kick it like this. She licking my lips, she digging my kicks, so we did it like this. It's Rick Ross, I'm the man of the hour. She love to make love and we can in the shower. Back against the wall, I'ma stand like a tower. Every time I'ma stand like a tower. Sometimes I rhyme quick, sometimes I buy blow, so I supply brick. You can't look me in the face, girl. When you're wrong, I'ma put you in your place, girl. My money long, I got money just to waste, girl. My money home and it's up to my waist, girl.
I really love how you shake, girl. You're like a phantom. I love how you shake, girl. Rick Ross, I'm a real nigga. You can feel the realness when I deal with you. Baby, I won't lie to you. I'm too honest, I promise I won't lie to you. That other bitch finish with. You the one I'm having dinner with. And it's candlelit. Can you handle it? Cause I can handle it. Well, let's handle this.
Peace, peace, peace. Welcome to High Frequency Radio. You're on the Tuesday night show, Sharif. We're going to dive in. First of all, I got to get started here and get pumped up. So let me throw on my little introduction.
Let's get ready to rumble!
All right, I'm pumped. Ready to get it in. All right, again, the call-in number is 424-222-5250. The email address for High Frequency Radio, in order to get on the contact list to be apprised of any future events that's going on, seminars, webinars, things of that nature, or important and impertinent information that would come from the variety of our hosts that's on this network, you can get on a email mailing list by contacting highfrequencyradioblogtalk@gmail.com. That's highfrequencyradioblogtalk@gmail.com. Or if you want to contact Brother Sharif, he can be reached at the Law Master, THEMASTER, 44@yahoo.com. The Law Master at 44@yahoo.com. And you can also get on my mailing list to be apprised of any future webinars, seminars, or information on your debt collection issues. We're going to move forward, get in the queue to answer your question. This show is going to be questions and answers. I don't really have much to go into by way of information. I'm going to read a couple of articles for the listeners that I thought may be pertinent and relevant to what those of you out there are going through. And then we're going to go straight to the calling line for questions and answers, comments, or concerns. All right. I'm going to read one article right here that might be interesting to those of you that pay attention to the economics of our world, to what's happening in our society in terms of your privacy, in terms of your ability to navigate in the commercial world, okay, in terms of legal matters, be it civil or criminal. And this is an interesting article I read on yesterday that I want to share. And the title of that article is The End of Private Property in the Era of the American Police State. All right. And this was written by one John Whitehead. He's the president of the Rutherford Institute and author of A Government of Wolves, The Emerging American Police State. Okay. And he starts off by a couple of commentaries from some of our Chief Justice and other notable authors in the world. No power on earth has a right to take our property from us without our consent. That was written by John Jay, who was the first Chief Justice of the United States. The second one is how secure do our homes remain if police armed with no warrant can pound on doors at will and forcibly enter? That was written by Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the lone dissenter in the case Tucky versus King. If the government can tell you what you can and cannot do within the privacy of your home, whether it relates to what you eat, what you smoke, or whom you love, you no longer have any rights whatsoever within your home. If government officials can fine and arrest you for growing vegetables in your front yard, praying with friends in your living room, installing solar panels on your roof, and raising chickens in your backyard, you no longer are the owner of your property. If school officials can punish your children for what they do or say while at home or in your care, your children are not your own. They are property of the state. If government agents can invade your home, break down your doors, kill your dog, damage your furnishings, and terrorize your family, your property is no longer private and secure. It belongs to the government. Likewise, if police can forcefully draw your blood, strip search you, and probe you intimately, your body is no longer your own either. This is what a world without the Fifth Amendment looks like, where the lines between private and public property have been so blurred that private property is reduced to little more than something the government can use to control, manipulate, and harass you to suit its own purposes. And you, the homeowner and citizen, if you deem yourself to be, have been reduced to little more than a tenant or serf in bondage to an inflexible landlord. Examples of this disregard for the sanctity of private property, whether in the form of one's home, one's possession, or one's person abound, here are just a few. Disregard for the sanctity of property. In Ohio, it's illegal to alter one's car with a hidden compartment if the intent is to conceal illegal drugs. Okay? In Florida and elsewhere throughout the country, home vegetable gardens are being targeted as illegal. All right? In Iowa, a veteran attempting to wean his family off expensive corporate farm products, GMOs, and pesticides has been charged with violating a city ordinance and now faces up to 30 days in jail and a $600 fine for daring to raise chickens in his backyard for personal use, despite statements of support from his neighbors. In Virginia, school officials have suspended two boys for the remainder of the school year and charged them with possession of a firearm after they were reported to police for playing with toy airsoft guns in their front yard while waiting for the morning school bus. At no time did the boys attempt to take the toy guns on the bus or to school. The most obvious disrespect for property rights comes in the form of the tens of thousands of SWAT team raids that occur across the country on a yearly basis, usually undertaken under the pretense of serving a drug warrant. These raids involve police arriving at private residents in SWAT gear, armed to the hilt, kicking down doors, apprehending all persons inside the home, then determining if a crime has been committed. That was Judy Sanchez's experience when FBI agents investigating gang activity used a chainsaw to cut through her door and then force Sanchez and her child to the ground. It was only after invading Sanchez's home and terrorizing her family that agents realized they had targeted the wrong address. These are just some of the incidents that take place in our society today. I thought it would be interesting, if not relevant, to what we go through with violations of our property rights, most of you dealing with foreclosures, dealing with illegitimate debt collectors. I thought that information may be relevant. I want to discuss one other article that was written that is pertaining to my show, and that's about debt collectors. All right. As we all know, there's always a governmental agency that oversees every aspect of commerce. Okay. As we know, in the courts, you have the courts that oversees the legal society. You have the FBI that oversees certain other agencies. Okay, for the debt collecting industry, we have what we call the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And the acronym for that bureau is CF, as in Frank, P as in Paul, B as in Barry, all right? The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. They are the governmental agency who is responsible for governing the actions and behaviors of debt collectors. The head of that bureau is the director of that bureau, rather, is Director Richard Cordray. Okay, he is an attorney, a bar attorney. Okay, and they have implemented this bureau not too long ago, and they've ramped up the authority of this bureau to govern the debt collectors as this business has grown since the collapse of real property several years ago. And they're quite aware that debt collectors have become substantially bigger, being that, as I've always said on this show, mom and pop debt collectors who were collecting defaulted cable bills and cell phone bills are now acting and parading as servicers, mortgagees, and creditors. So this particular arena caught the eye of the government, and they had this protection bureau to come in, established for the purpose of governing those debt collectors. And I'm going to read the article. The government is preparing restrictions on debt collectors, a loosely regulated industry under increasing scrutiny, over complaints of abusive tactics. On Wednesday, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is slated to issue a notice of proposed rulemaking to modernize the legal framework governing debt collection. The government watchdog is seeking public and business comment before formally proposing the rules, which are expected to be finalized by next year. The Bureau is asking Americans whether creditors and collection agencies are providing accurate information about their outstanding debts. It also wants to know whether people are receiving threatening calls at all hours of the night or being dragged into court for money they do not owe. Collection of consumer debt serves an important role in the proper functioning of consumer credit markets. CFPB Director Richard Cordray said Tuesday on a call with reporters, but certain debt collection practices have long been a source of frustration for many consumers. Cordray noted that since the Bureau began accepting debt collection complaints in July, it has received about 5,000 consumer grievances. The most common complaints involve harassing phone calls, lack of verification of the debt, which is what I speak about here, and people becoming aware of a collection account only through their credit report. The $12.2 billion debt collection industry has routinely been criticized for tactics used to get consumers to settle their balances. Industry groups support the Bureau's effort to update the system, but caution against rules that prohibit creditors or collection agencies from lawfully recovering debt. Modernization can't hinder the economic survival of public and private sector organizations, nor can it relinquish the personal responsibilities of America's consumers to pay what they rightfully owe, said Pat Morris, chief executive of the Association of Credit and Collection Professionals, a trade group with 5,000 members. The debt collection industry has become more sophisticated since the 1977 enactment of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, a federal law to protect consumers from abusive tactics. The statute, which has undergone few changes, does not account for the industry's use of the Internet, auto dollars, and social media. The law also fails to fully address the emergence of companies that purchase past due accounts for pennies on the dollar, something that I consistently make aware to my callers. These debt buyers often acquire just a spreadsheet. Listen carefully. These debt buyers often acquire just a spreadsheet with names of delinquent borrowers from banks and credit card companies after accounts become more than 180 days overdue. Is that not in compliance with what I teach here on High Frequency Radio? All they acquire is a spreadsheet with names of delinquent borrowers from banks and credit card companies after the account becomes 180 days overdue. So if you are losing your house and being sued by a debt collector, and all they have is a spreadsheet, you should be ashamed of yourself if you've listened to my show even once. Judges across the country have raised concerns about the number of cases involving debt buyers that contain generic testimony, not admissible evidence, not competent fact witnesses, but generic testimony or lack proof of outstanding debt. In response, a group of 13 state attorney generals has been investigating these firms, as well as the banks and credit card companies that sell them the debt. The concerns about credit card debt collection echoes complaints about shoddy foreclosure practices after the housing market crashed. In those cases, as homeowners defaulted on their loans in droves, mortgage servicers were accused of falsifying records and robo-signing hundreds of documents without reviewing them. Similarly, debt collectors and banks have filed hundreds of thousands of lawsuits against delinquent credit card holders in the wake of the financial crisis. As millions of Americans fall behind on payments, the charge-off rate for credit cards soared to $85 billion by the end of 2009, according to the credit card comparison website CardHub. Debt collection also has more salience today than perhaps at any time in our country's history, Cordry said, noting that nearly 1 in 10 Americans has an average of $1,400 in debt subject to collection. Consumers deserve to be treated with dignity and respect, and businesses should be able to operate fairly and reasonably to collect the debts they are legitimately owed. The CFPB's authority extends to three types of debt collectors: companies that buy defaulted debt and collect the proceeds for themselves, firms that recover defaulted debt owned by another company in return for a fee, and lawyers who collect through litigation. All right, that's an interesting article, and those were not my words, although they may sound like them. That came from your governing body, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. They just told you that the only thing these debt collectors normally receive is a spreadsheet and your name. A spreadsheet and your name and some general flimsy testimony from a person that doesn't have firsthand knowledge of any debt. If you are facing a debt collector today or in the future, that information from your Consumer Financial Protection Bureau should be an indication, okay, or some wake-up salt for you to understand that you must challenge these debt collectors and have them provide admissible evidence and a competent fact witness that will support their claims. But with a spreadsheet, I am very curious to understand why we would be losing our real property worth hundreds of thousands of dollars when all that debt collector has spreadsheet and a name. And for most of you that sent out QWRs and debt validation disputes, you cannot sit on this call and tell me that the debt collector sent you anything more than a spreadsheet or some documents you already had in your possession or your name, or they pieced together from the county records that holds those documents from the past. They pieced together the fact that you may or may not owe a debt, and they're guessing as to what debt is owed, how much is owed, and to whether or not you owe that debt. With that type of information, okay, that a debt collector has, I cannot understand why you would lose any debt collection case or, at worst, losing your property to some third, fourth, fifth generation debt collector. All right, we're going to go to the call lines. Again, press 1 if you have a question. I'm going to go right to the lines and try to make this show entirely about answering questions and getting the information out there to the nation and the listening audience regarding any debt collection issues they may have. The first call I'm going to go to is going to be 615-7 ending in 6988. 615 ending in 6988. Welcome to High Frequency Radio. You're on the Sharif Show. Do you have a question, comment, or concern?
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning, brother. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, I got a situation, a statement, and a question. I had a detainer hearing last Tuesday.
Here where,
sir? I'm in Tennessee, Nashville.
All right.
And I raised several of the issues that you had put us on notice of as far as them being debt collectors. It was against Fannie Mae, and the actual lawyers for Fannie Mae were the same people who allegedly conducted the foreclosure sale. And I brought all these things to the attention of the judge at a hearing, and he basically overlooked everything. So my question was, how do we effectively bring that before the court to establish that they are, or get them to recognize that they are debt collectors in violation of those codes?
Okay. All right, brother, I'll answer that question, and this is no pun intended to you, but as a nation and as a society, we often wait far too long to begin executing our remedy or defense against wrongful foreclosure or debt collection. And what happens is, between the time that you were getting notices of default about your alleged mortgage, you have probably received many letters, many warnings. You probably were in a non-judicial state, and you probably allowed that foreclosure train to get started, get going, and gain momentum and speed without you providing any defense or attempting to slow down that foreclosure train. So you let it go past the point of foreclosure, and you let it get to the final stage of an eviction. And what most judges, in my opinion, let me finish, in my opinion, what most judges will do is ignore you because you had an opportunity up until that point to defend your property by bringing an action, okay, to circumvent the foreclosure. So once you get to the point where the lender is actually there knocking on your door and ready to put you in the street and you start bringing up those defenses, which in a summary judgment court, an eviction court, which is normally lower level magistrate courts, they can't hear matters of title, debt collectors. The only issue before the court is, are you a tenant, one, which you're not. You're a property owner. Your name is on title. So therefore, that court would be inadequate because you're not a tenant. Number two is that you should have brought an action that has to do with title, and that action should have been brought before your eviction. So if eviction started, then you would have said, hold up, judge, you need to stay your action about evicting me because there is an issue of title that's pending in the superior court or state court. And until that issue of title has been determined, you can't proceed with an eviction. But being that you didn't do that and you allowed that train to go for so long, most judges are going to say, well, you haven't paid a payment in three, four years. You didn't do anything to stop your foreclosure. You gave, and in between foreclosure and eviction is usually several months to a year. So he felt, what were you doing in between that time? Now you want to bring up a debt collector. Well, he can't hear a debt collection case because he don't have a debt collection case before him. He has an eviction before him. So the only thing you could have said at that point was, Your Honor, where is the lease agreement? Okay. That proves that I am some tenant, okay, unlawfully inhabiting this property. I'm not a tenant. Do you have a landlord-tenant agreement? If you don't have that, then the court does not have subject matter jurisdiction. I don't know what kind of foreclosure this debt collector did. It's non-judicial. I cannot monitor that, nor does the court monitor non-judicial foreclosures. They can be done in the bathroom. They can be done in the backyard or at a barbecue. I don't know. What I do know is that I don't know what foreclosure took place, and I know I'm not a tenant. I'm a property owner. So you should have started an action
that has to do with title, whether it's a quiet title action, whether it's a wrong to foreclosure action or any tort action, that would have eliminated the subject matter jurisdiction of that eviction court. All right, what was your second question?
I was just going to give you some background information. Just to let you know, I initially did file a lawsuit back in 2009 before the alleged foreclosure actually happened. But the actions that I brought it were fraud, money had and received, and unjust enrichment. And I brought it in federal court. And when I started doing it, I really didn't know what I was doing.
Right.
So not, you know, to one of the knowledge that I have now. But this case went on. I appealed it all the way up to the Supreme Court. And I actually didn't get into Supreme Court because of process deficiencies, time. Excuse me. You know, they was getting me for defects in my process. So at the same time I had this case going on, they filed the action for unlawful detainer in state court. At the same time I had, I was in appeals court at the time they filed the action for unlawful detainer. So this had actually been going on for over a year. They filed in 2012 in May, this unlawful detainer action, and it just came to a close last week. After
I understand. I believe you were on a call before. You called in before, didn't you?
No. This is my actual first time speaking.
Okay.
I listened,
okay.
So I spoke to you.
Gotcha. Yeah, so, all right, let me address for you, brother. I mean, you know, unjust enrichment and fraud. You know, those are tort claims of fraud. You have to prove intent. Those are very difficult to prove. And as a novice just starting out with a lawsuit, I can see where you probably have some procedural defects in trying to present that case. You know, again, we just deal with debt collectors, okay? Don't deal with unjust enrichment, because how can you prove they were enriched? You never paid them. They said you were in default. You hadn't made a payment since default. So who was the enriched? So we have to be careful with those type of causes of action, because they don't apply. You should have been having a cause of action for wrongful foreclosure under the FDCPA, the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, under your state consumer protection laws, and you should have said this is a debt collector and I don't know who they are or what they claim I owe. But they haven't proved that I owe them anything. And keep it really simple. And keep it to where the court can understand and you can understand what you're saying. But I understand you went all the way up to the Supreme Court, but you didn't bring the proper action, which has to do with title. Who has the superior claim on title? You know, you didn't bring those type of causes of action. So, of course, Fannie Mae, who is nothing but a debt collector. Fannie Mae didn't loan you any money. Fannie Mae guarantees loans. So I know from Fannie Mae being involved that your loan was sold into the secondary market via securitization, and your loan was securitized. You should not ever lose your property to Fannie Mae. Fannie Mae is not listed on your documents as a lender, and they probably sent you some documentation saying that they were an investor. Well, what is an investor? If you look within your mortgage documents, I don't care what documents you have, whether you have a mortgage, a security deed, a deed of trust, the term investor is never used. So you didn't ask the question, what is an investor? Either you're a creditor, a mortgagee, or a lender. What is an investor? An investor is a debt collector, because debt collectors invest in purchasing defaulted debt. Okay, so when they said they were in an investor, that should have been a cue for you to say investor. Well, you point out where investor, that term is used in any of these documents that I hold. So, you know, Fannie Mae should not be pursuing any eviction or collection of any mortgage or any debt. So, you know, those issues right now, have they conducted the eviction? Have you lost the eviction yet?
They had the alleged motion hearing where they ruled in their favor, in Fannie Mae's favor, and said that they were had entitled to possession or whatever. He issued them a writ of possession, and I've appealed it.
Right, but if you appeal it, now they're going to have you pay market value rent into the court registry. What you should have did was did a quiet title action and any other torts you wanted to bring in the superior court, okay, and filed a motion to stay the eviction, or did a motion to consolidate those two cases since you had an issue of title. And a summary judgment court, magistrate court, cannot determine title issues. They can't determine debt collecting issues. They just determine whether you're a tenant and whether they're a landlord and whether they're entitled to possession. And with the counter defenses you put up, he wasn't able to determine that they wasn't, they shouldn't be awarded possession. So what you should do, even if you appeal it at this point, you're going to have to put up a bond, or they're going to ask that you pay market value rent to Fannie Mae into the court registry while that appeal is being adjudicated.
Right.
Okay. That's something you may be interested in doing, or consult an attorney or consultant and consider a bankruptcy, okay, and bring you an adversary proceeding or a motion, which is a complaint, to determine the validity of the lien. Which you're saying that I don't think Fannie Mae has any interest in this estate property, and Fannie Mae needs to prove their claim. All right, that's my suggestion to you on the course you may take to kind of continue ownership of your property.
All right, appreciate the feedback.
Okay,
brother.
Sir. Thank you, brother, and good luck to you. And email me if you have any further questions.
All right, I did. I'll talk to you later.
All right, brother. Peace. Thanks. All right. I just want to make the callers aware, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and all of those agencies, if you ever have documentation that lists them, what Fannie and Freddie are doing, since they were guarantors and insured most of the secondary securitization RMIC pools, a lot of times because these banks ripped off Fannie and Freddie Mac, to the tune of billions and trillions, and you can see it out there. It's public knowledge that, you know, Fannie and Freddie has settled billion-dollar settlements with these banks because basically they stole from the government. And the deal that they're making is, you know, in order for Bank of America, Chase, Wells Fargo to pay Fannie and Freddie back, they are maneuvering paperwork, fabricating documents, and sort of just really signing over your debt to Fannie Mae. And being the type of weight that Fannie and Freddie hold, being governmental agencies, so to speak, although they are private, then they hold a lot of weight to the courts because your judges is not going to want to go against the government and not give them the property. So Fannie Mae is, in essence, just coming and jacking your house, saying that you owe them something. But again, I don't see how anyone out there would have property and have a governmental agency like Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac coming to take your house and you not question or ask the question, who are you? And again, as you know, Sharif's big thing is identify. Who are you? I heard of you, Fannie and Freddie Mae. I never got a loan from you, though. I never paid a payment to you. You're not listed on my title. You're not in the county recorder. I mean, who are you, and how did you come about owning or allegedly owning some debt that I did with an entity more than likely that's dead, that's been dissolved, or insolvent in bankruptcy? So those are the questions that you should be asking. And when you are ever in an eviction with a debt collector, your first question is, where am I a tenant, and where is the lease agreement that I executed with this stranger to any transaction I may or may not have participated in? Where is the lease agreement? Judge, you're saying I'm a tenant. They're saying I'm a tenant. Provide me with the lease agreement. Okay. If they cannot provide that, then the debt collector has not invoked the subject matter of that court. Okay? Because subject matter means the authority to hear a case. Okay? Federal court can hear state and federal claims. They have concurrent jurisdiction. Okay? State court cannot hear federal claims. All right? Magistrate court, summary court cannot hear federal claims. Okay? So if you're in an eviction proceeding, okay, and the court doesn't have jurisdiction because you're not a tenant, then why are you not putting up that defense and say, I don't know who these people are? I have title. Here's title, copy of a quitclaim deed, or whatever title document you have that deems you a owner of the property, okay? And just verbally you can say to the judge, Judge, I'm the owner of this property. I'm not a tenant. And you need to have this debt collector, the alleged plaintiff, provide what documentation they are relying upon to determine that I am some tenant, very simply. It's not difficult. It's not hard. As you guys know, I can talk all fancy and in language marinated in legalese, but there's no need to. Just keep it plain in English. Who are you? What debt are you talking about? And where's the lease agreement that authorizes you to evict me from my real property? All right, we're going to go to the next question. We're going to open up the line for 614-2324. 614-2324, you are on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question, comment, or concern?
Yeah.
I'm doing well. How are you? State your name for the record,
please. Oh, this is LeVar Hopkins calling out of Columbus.
All right. All right, LeVar, how you doing?
Yeah,
Columbus, Ohio?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I got a question. I got this collection company coming after me about a credit card, and I sent them a debt validation letter asking to provide any proof that I had this card or whatever, which they did not do. But they did respond with a letter asking to speak to my attorney, and they provided these transactions with payments down in Atlanta, but it's still not me. That like they didn't provide anything else. So I'm
okay, what kind
like,
of letter? This is a credit card debt. Did you send them a debt validation dispute pursuant to 15 U.S.C. 1692G?
Yes.
Okay. And they responded with permission. You have an attorney? You have an ongoing case right now or a bankruptcy case?
Well, in the letter it said, we believe that you're being represented by an attorney. Can we please speak to your attorney?
Okay.
And I have 30 days. To provide that proof. If I don't, then they'll believe that I'm not being represented by an attorney, but they didn't provide me any proof that the debt was like they just sent these transactions.
Okay.
Where like it had
I got you on that, LeVar. What I'm asking you is just pay attention to my question. Do you have an attorney or some ongoing litigation right now to give them the impression that you are represented by counsel? Because for some reason they're covering themselves, because under the FDCPA, if you have ongoing litigation and you're represented by counsel and they go around that counsel, it is a violation mm-hmm. subject to liability under 1692K when you have an attorney. So they're covering themselves and they're just not going to pull that out of their pocket. Do you have some litigation going on, or are you in bankruptcy or was in bankruptcy?
No, I don't. I'm not in bankruptcy. I don't have any litigation going
on.
I just got the letter in the mail, and I just sent that out to just ask for proof, and that was it.
Okay. Well, I don't know why they thought you had an attorney, but, you know, for some reason they did. Maybe you filed – did you ever file a bankruptcy and close it?
Nah, never had a bankruptcy. Like, it was just the letter I put together. Maybe it sounded like that. I don't know. But
maybe your letter was good, and they say, wait a minute, he has to be backed up by an attorney, or maybe he's been listening to the Sharif show, but he sounds really legally minded, okay, and we need to be careful, because I know an attorney had to either assist or prepare this letter for him. What I would do is simply, if you didn't get the response you needed to get, which you won't, because I read you that article from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, really they don't have any information to give you. So they're waiting for you to acquiesce or waiting for you to begin speaking about subject matter, either admitting or alleging or alluding to the fact that you have a debt. So again, what I teach on this show is, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't recall a debt with who you're talking about. I have no idea what you're talking about, and I need you to provide validation and or verification pursuant to 1692G, 15 U.S.C. the FDCPA, along with your state consumer protection law. Okay? So what I would do in that case, you know, 30 days, you have to look for this pitfall that most debt collectors will do, and I want to share this with you and the listeners. One of the violations they will often do is to tell you within their Dunning letter that you have 30 days to dispute the debt in writing. I want everybody to look for that statement within any of their Dunning letters and communications. If a debt collector tells you you have 30 days to dispute the debt in writing, that is a violation of the FDCPA, because the FDCPA does not say you have to do so in writing. You can do it verbally, okay? You can call the debt collector on the phone, or if they call you, you can say, I dispute the alleged debt, and pursuant to 15 U.S.C. 1692G, I demand verification or validation of your alleged debt, and provide that in writing. So you don't have to do it in writing, okay? Now, they can ask you to provide a dispute within 30 days, but you are not held to that 30 days because you don't have to be in town. You could not be there. You could be in the military. You could be a truck driver. They're asking you that question to respond in 30 days so they can know how to proceed in collection of that alleged debt. What I would do is simply, what others have to understand as well is that if you send that dispute to the debt collector, they don't have 30 days to respond with validation and or verification. Simply, if a debt collector sends you a letter like they did, LeVar, and said, you owe a debt, you know, pay it, and you send them a dispute, if they stop communicating with you, if they cease and desist collecting that debt, they're okay. Okay? Right. If they stop, if you send them a letter and they don't send you any more letters and they're not reporting to your credit and they make no more further attempts to collect that debt prior to validating or verifying it, then they have not violated the FDCPA. They have to continue collecting that debt, okay, aside from validating or verifying it. If they send you something that you don't understand, a spreadsheet like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau said they have, and your name and some printouts, some screen printouts from their screen, you can just send a notice back and be like, I don't know what type of information you sent me, but I'm not able to determine any legitimate debt from the information you sent. You are hereby demanded to cease and desist all collection until you are able to provide clear documentation and admissible evidence of the alleged debt you purport to claim. Simply. All right? And if they stop what they're doing and go about their way, LeVar, good to go. If they continue to collect, you need to go ahead to your small claims court or go ahead and prepare your federal suit and sue them for violation of the FDCPA and your state consumer protection laws.
Okay, appreciate that.
No problem, brother. Good luck. And let me know if you need anything further. All right.
Okay, thanks.
We're going to move on. We're going to go to 410, ending in 1024. 410, ending in 1024. You are on high-frequency radio. Do you have a question, comment, or concern?
Islam, Brother Sharif.
Islam, brother. How you doing?
I'm doing well. This is LG Ali. I'm out of Maryland.
All right, brother. Peace.
Yes, sir. I have a couple of questions. They're concerning student loan collectors. Are they actually debt collectors, or are they creditors for life?
That's a good question, and I'll answer that because it's a question that I'm sure everybody on the call will be blessed by. Student loans are securitized. If you don't notice, what happened when our brother Obama came into office was, you know, Sallie Mae and all those other entities, he cut them, okay? Sallie Mae was like a in-between person, all right? They were the person that you went to, but they really got the money from the government, and they made a little something on it, okay? They're the middleman. So what happened was a lot of people like myself and others that is privy to the type of information I share with the nation was starting to sue these debt collectors because they knew they didn't hold the note. These agencies don't hold student loans. They're backed by the government. They're funded by the government, and they're just in-betweeners, just like these foreclosures, just like these banks. They never provided the funds for the loan. They received it from the investors on Wall Street via the REMICs, okay, via secondary market securitization. So they never funded any of these loans. Neither did these agencies that purport to have loaned you student loans. So they can be sued as debt collectors, and you definitely can, depending on who it is. But what Mr. Obama did was he came in and he got rid of the middleman. And he said, Sally and all the rest of you guys, we're going to go ahead and send you packing, and we're going to just deal with the students for student loans, meaning that you're getting your loans now directly from the government. And, you know, the government is just going to go ahead and tax you, take your tax return, and you're not going to be able to really buck too much against them. That's what they feel. But they're not aware of our show. But at any rate, you send them a debt validation dispute. They are not creditors for life. You need to identify who it is, and you send them the same kind of debt validation dispute and say, what debt are you talking about? What student loan? Are you the principal? Are you the creditor? You know, who are you collecting for? Are you collecting for someone? Did you fund this loan? Is the loan backed by the government? These are the questions you want to ask them. And if they buck, and you need to look at your credit report and see who's reporting that student loan. A lot of times they're very ambiguous and vague, but you need to do your digging and investigation and determine who are these payments going to and where are those loans. But most of those student loans were securitized. Okay, so the hedge funds and things of that nature. So, no, I would venture to say none of your loans are owned by any of the parties that more than likely is trying to collect from you. And we've been very successful at suing these agencies and getting student loans removed, okay, because you can always catch them, send them a debt validation dispute, ask them for specific information, and if they deviate or if they violate, you sue them. And you get damages for their wrongful violations.
Yes, sir.
Did you have a second question?
Yes, sir. I had them consolidate after I started questioning the credit bureau about my about these loans or so-called loans. They consolidated every. I had 21 of them on there over a 10-year or 20-year period.
Sure.
They consolidated all of them and gave me one file number on my credit report. They changed all the file numbers and just gave me one account number. Is that normal?
Like I said, your president cut the middle people out. As you see, Sallie Mae and all those people that were in the student loan business, they cut them clean out the middle. Because they were losing too much money, and the people getting educated as people on this show, and in debt collection and consumer protection was just obliterating them in court, and getting rid of these student loans. So the government's like, wait a minute, now they're attacking the middleman because the middleman never funded the deal. So you're gonna deal with the government now, and if you don't pay us, we know you're gonna file some taxes, or we know where your assets are. We're just gonna go ahead and check it out your check. So what they do, they consolidate those loans, and basically they'll just say owned by the government, okay, instead of owned by Sallie Mae and all these other vehicles that they use, these middle people, it's just going to be, they'll consolidate into one loan and be owned by the government, and you're just going to be dealing with the government. Now, if you're not scared, go ahead and sue the government and be like, well, you know, my documentation says that Sallie Mae owned that particular loan. How did it get to the government? Okay, how did you come to own it? Just like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mae, they can be sued in court and they lose in court. The brother that was just on from Columbus, Ohio, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac has been slapped around in Ohio like crazy and other states. So if you're not afraid and you have the propensity to bring an action against whoever is trying to economically enslave you, then you can bring an action and be like, tell me or show me the chain of title where you were assigned this loan from Sallie Mae or whatever other entity was used as a middle person who said that they funded this loan. I need to know when you became the owner of the loan. And ask them specific questions. Ask them very specific questions and tell them to provide you with an answer. And if that answer is not satisfactory, go ahead and take them to small claims court or federal court if you're able to, or get you an attorney who you will be allowed to under the consumer protection laws, obtain attorney fees, okay, if you're successful, and go after them, brother.
Yes, sir. All right. Thank you, Brother Sharif.
All right.
Appreciate
Thank you, sir. No problem. Be blessed. All right, we're going to go to the next caller here, 615-1652, 615-1652. You are on High Frequency Radio, Sharif Show. Do you have a question, comment, or concern?
Good day, Brother Sharif. This is Brother Smiles down in Tennessee.
All right, Brother Smiles. Good day, man. How's everything?
Man, everything is everything. I don't know.
Tennessee
is
in
questions.
The house, brother. You know the other brother that called?
Yeah, that's my homeboy. That's my homeboy.
All right, so y'all in the same house calling in, huh?
No, we're not in the same house, but we're in the same area for sure.
That's good, man. Stick together. You're a nation. I like that. What's your question,
brother?
That's
right. There's one question I want to follow up with him associated to it because I don't think he really got to it. Maybe he's going to email you about it. But what the courts are trying to do is invoke the clause or paragraph 22 in the deed of trust wherein they state that you have agreed to a tenant being a tenant if you go into default. So I just would like
that language is in there. I was going to get into that, but it was going to be a little bit too long-winded. But some mortgage do say that. They do transpose you into a tenant when you become in default. But this is what I have to say to that. Does that agreement apply to you, or are you a stranger to that contract? Who are you to point out or extrapolate anything that has to do with a contract that may or may not have been valid or may be extinguished by operation of law? So, again, you have to say to them, I understand what the contracts say, but show me where your name is on that contract.
Right.
See, what these lenders are doing and what these debt collectors are doing are basically insinuating to the court, well, Judge, they owe somebody. So since I took the stance or I took the opportunity to sue them talking about that contract, they should pay me. I should be the one to get the house. And I've actually said that to people, to judges. Well, who are they? Well, they say you owe a debt to somebody. Yeah, well, somebody, who is that? All right?
Right.
Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 17, you got to be the real party in interest. I don't know who people are. So what you say is because you know about a contract that you can take my $200,000 property because something you looked in section 22. Did you also look in the other sections and see where what you're supposed to do if you are a creditor or if you are a mortgagee? So you want to pull out one section that you think applies to you that gives you the most authority for you to take my property, but you ignored all the other 19 or 21 that you're supposed to abide by. You see what I mean?
That's
it
correct.
Becomes a game. And then you have to challenge that. You'd be like, Judge, you don't have like I hear many of their brothers say in their criminal matters, you know, you don't have jurisdiction. You don't have jurisdiction. I'm not a tenant, and this person has no right to subrogation of this contract. Who are they? These are debt collectors. Debt collectors are not entitled to property. 15 U.S.C. 1692I. Did y'all read that? When did you acquire this alleged debt, sir? Oh, when it was in default. Okay, so you're a debt collector, right? Now show me where you have the authority as a debt collector to take property.
Right.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you just heard a brother call before on the phone, and he was speaking about a credit card debt. He never said that the debt collector showed up at his house to confiscate any of the items he may have bought with that credit card, pots, pans, jewelry, clothes, boots, hats. He just said they were trying to sue him on the debt. That's all a debt collector can do is sue you allegedly for the debt that you receive, but they're not entitled to property. They've never been entitled to property. So, you know, that's something that, your contract reads that, but don't ever let anybody take out one part of a contract, okay, and try to make that a case. They have to take the entire contract. So then what you're saying is, sir, you're saying somehow you have a nexus or connection to that contract, right? Not just Section 20. You have a nexus and connection to that contract in its entirety. Right? Okay. So if you have a nexus, then I've been waiting for the real creditor, and I know you're not it, but since you want to play that role, I'm going to go ahead and hit you with this lawsuit, okay, and I'm going to treat you like a creditor because you have a lot of cause of action and a lot of breaches pursuant to that same contract you speak of, and you need to sue them. But you need to get it out that court and get it over into a state court, and you need to do that methodically. So what I tell everybody is don't wait till the last minute. You've gotten 100 letters from these debt collectors before they actually get to the point where they're knocking on your door to kick you and your family out your house. As a nation, we are always slow to take matters into our hand and take our stance amongst the affairs of men. You need to be, this show is designed to teach you to go on the offense, okay, and start suing them, okay, before they even come after you. Because, again, and I can understand this to a point. When these judges sit before you and you've let 2 or 3 years go by, you haven't made a payment. I mean, it's just simple that, you know, if you're not going to make a payment, and I understand you're not making a payment to somebody you don't owe, but then take that money, okay, that you should have or maybe could have been paying a real creditor, since they're not around, not a debt collector, take that money, okay, that you're not paying to a lender and invest in defending your property. When are you going to take some of that money and put it back into your situation? Or have we just gotten used to not having any payments? You don't want to pay anybody else to do it. You don't want. You just want to buy some boots. You want to buy the new Jordans coming out. You want to go out. You want to get another car. I mean, but you don't want to take some of that money and invest in keeping that debt collector at bay or making sure they're not able ever to collect on it.
Right, right. Let me follow up with that, though, because that's a good point you just made. Now, what if, and this is what I'm planning on doing. I'm intending on, before I get to the point where my partner's at, but I'm about to set up an escrow account, and before I get to that point and direct the judge to say, Your Honor, look, I've already set up this escrow account, and I've never missed a payment, and I'm making payments monthly. Until such a time that they're able to prove that they are the proper party, I will continue to make payments into this escrow account. If they're not able to prove
like,
they're the proper party, then we move forward to dismiss them completely.
I like that idea. It's not a bad idea. I'm against putting any money into the court registry, which a lot of time what these courts are starting to do. They're starting to require homeowners to start depositing payments into the court registry. I don't trust that because I don't trust the decision.
Right.
More than likely it's going to follow subsequently. But, you know, put it into an escrow and be like, look, there may or may not be a creditor out there, but I know the people that are coming after me are not. So that money will stay in escrow until a certain time or until you bring a viable action against them in the form of quiet title or whatever, and go ahead, or let me make this statement, until the statute of limitations has been told, okay? That's
right.
The probably one of the most important things that we don't pay attention to is the statute of limitations. You want quiet title without getting quiet title? Let the statute of limitations expire. Now they can't come after you or sue you about that debt. They can still try to collect it, okay, but they can't sue you about it, all right? So, you know,
okay.
So the simple thing is once the statute of limitations is gone, you just got to say one sentence. You're barred from collecting by the statute of limitations. It's simple, one sentence.
Right.
You got to go,
right.
You don't even have to write it, one sentence. I don't know what this debt collector is doing. He's barred by the statute of limitations, which is 3 years or 4 years in the state of Tennessee. Therefore, the case should be dismissed with prejudice in its entirety. One sentence,
right.
One paragraph. That's it. So we have to look at all these different strategies and laws that's available to us to go on the offense and stop always being on the defense. Put yourself in the power seat and be a plaintiff and start directing what information you need to determine whether you have a creditor in front of you or a pretender lender in front of you. And that's what you need
right.
to do. So go on the offense now, brother, before they even get, you know, to the point where they're evicting you. And that way, when you have that action open in a state or federal court, you can always stay the action of a lower court until you determine who has superior title.
Right. Okay, I got one more question. This is going to be the last one, hopefully.
Sure.
I'm sure to help
right.
people out as well. I got a Dunning letter on November the 15th, and I did a validation of debt letter associated to it. But they sent another letter before their 30 days ended on December the 6th. Is that a violation of the FDCPA pursuant to their own letter and the FDCPA?
Say that one more time for me. I lost you a little bit.
Okay. They sent a letter on November the 15th. I sent a debt validation letter on December the 9th. But before I sent the debt validation letter, they sent another letter on December the 6th. Before the 30 days within their own letter, as well as before the 30 days prescribed by the FDCPA. So I'm just wondering, is that a violation of the FDCPA if they send a letter saying that you failed to respond?
Of course. If they did so, if they sent you a letter and before the 30 days had expired, they sent you another
right.
letter and said, I've never
yeah.
seen a debt collector say you haven't responded. But, yeah, if they
yeah.
did that, let me tell you something. These debt collection companies and banks, they're machines. Do you understand? They will spit
right.
you out letters that you're not supposed to get. Sometimes it's just procedure. It's just the computer doing what it's programmed to do. You have to take advantage of that and say, I received this letter but didn't receive this letter, and you need to go ahead and sue and get your $1,000 statutory damages,
right,
your actual damages, your attorney fees and costs, and go ahead and sue them, because they can continue to make mistakes. It's a computer.
Mm-hmm.
They can't handle thousands of millions of accounts and do it all in order. I'm telling you right now, they set up a fund for those type of mistakes. They know they're
right.
going to pay out some people that may appear on this show and has the wherewithal to be able to go after them. So sit back and wait. They're never going to give you specific information. They can't keep up. Hopefully by the
right.
you know, I have 80 callers, 90, 100 and something callers. Hopefully everybody on this phone call, if they were all to receive a letter from everybody on this phone call, they can't keep up. So you got to go ahead and take advantage of that. They got money.
Yeah.
You know, all I speak about is getting money. I don't speak about nothing but getting money. That's the only thing that motivates me. I talk about religion. We can talk about all that. I'm a student. Look, I listen to Yousef all throughout the week while I'm working. So I'm a student
right.
on other matters, but I'm about getting that money. Okay? And the debt
right.
collectors have it for you. I'm telling you.
Yep, the letter's going out today, so I'm ready.
Send the letter out, brother. Keep good documentation. Utilize your small claims court. If you're not familiar with the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, your small claims court will do just as well. Some of you have some small state consumer protection laws that are strong. But, again, you just want an order from the judge saying that you're a debt collector, you violate the FDCPA, you're not a creditor. That's all you want, the judge, a declaratory judgment. Hey, judge, you tell me who they are. Now, they say they acquired this debt while it was in default, 2 years, 3 years while it was in default, and they're trying to act like they're a mortgagee or a creditor. Can you just tell me, based on your knowledge of the law and this documentation, whether they are a debt collector or a creditor, and whether a debt collector can use instrumentation of a creditor like an assignment and talk mortgage talk and all that other language that doesn't apply to them. And that's all you want is an order. I don't care, judge, if you give me $50. I just need your determination of who they are so I know how to treat them from now on, and so they know what line not to cross. You got it?
Exactly. Appreciate it. Appreciate it.
All right, brother. Peace.
Thanks.
All right. All right. All right, we're going to go to the next caller here, 704-704. I believe that's Virginia, 2642, 704-2642. Again, press 1 if you have a question. 2642, you on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question, comment, or concern? Welcome to the show.
Oh. Gabe, hey, Brother Sharice, how you doing today? This is great.
How well, how are you, sister? Thank you.
I'm great. I just wanted to ask you, this is not my main question, but since you mentioned the statute of limitations, When does the actual statute of limitations begin? Like, does it begin the date of the supposed default, or does it does it begin the date that, let's say, you went to court? It took you to court. These debt collecting attorneys took you to court, and let's say the judgment went for them, but they never have done anything as far as kicking you out since that time. So when does
the statute of limitation begins? On the date of the last payment, normally, generally, it applies to the date of your last payment. But again, one of the strategies that I use, being that I read you the report from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and the information that I've always proffered to the nation and this audience, is how do the debt collector know when you made a last payment? How does that spreadsheet identify when you ever made a payment? A spreadsheet is just going to have information that can be, and you notice the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau said a spreadsheet. We all know spreadsheets, as well as notes, as well as mortgages, as well as deeds, as well as assignments, can be manipulated and altered. So I don't know if you put that payment in there to extend, okay, your collection period, which is called re-aging the debt, or I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't make a payment on that alleged account that last year. I don't remember making a payment at all. Who are you? So when you talk about statute of limitation, you should always be able to creatively create a statute of limitation for yourself, because you have to have that debt collector prove that I made a payment. I've had attorneys, okay, in cases that I've helped, I have attorneys apply a payment, okay, to an account to make it look to extend the statute of limitations. They actually do that. I'm not saying they all do that. But listen, when you're dealing with a mortgage or a $20,000 credit card case or a $200,000 mortgage, don't think they won't be creative enough to say, well, you made a payment over here. Well, prove it. That's, you just have flimsy documentation, as the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau said. Flimsy documentation, you're saying I made a payment on this day. Prove it. Show me the check. Show me the cancel check. Can they get that cancel check? No. Nope. They don't have it. So when is the statute of limitations? Honestly, in my opinion, for my students and listeners, when you say it is. And if you're smart, you should put any alleged payment was probably made 4 years ago if you have a 3-year statute of limitation. Okay? You have to get creative because, again, the only information they know is what you admit. Did you have another question?
Yeah. Well, my main question is, if you have a, I'm helping a lady of mine, old lady of mine. She's a client because I do the credit repair, and she's actually fighting an attorney for a debt collector on a judgment that they got on her back in 2009. Yeah, 2009, and they have a judgment against her. However, what I did when I took her on is I sent them a validation, debt validation request, which of course the only thing they do is send you a copy of. Computer-generated copy of the credit transaction. No,
sure.
So at this point, since the sheriff is now at the point where he is or she is trying to collect because there's a judgment, she's trying to collect on the alleged debt. Now, can I actually, on her behalf, and help her file a FDCPA claim against them in the federal court, or is it too late because of the judgment, and how do I handle the sheriff who's trying to collect?
Okay, just briefly, it sounds like you probably want to get with me offline, but you need to do a Rule 60B pursuant to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. You can write that down, a Rule 60B motion to set aside void judgment or motion to set aside judgment based on one of the existing remedies within a Rule 60B motion, okay? It can be fraud. It can be evidence you determined later. It can be that the court never had – you can challenge jurisdiction at any time. The court never had subject matter jurisdiction. I wasn't served properly. The proper party didn't bring the action. You need to go ahead and do that first, okay? And then the court is supposed to give you a hearing. But you have to make sure you really plead that correctly. It has to be structured. It has to be in format. You have to have some good justification, maybe some case law to go with it. So it needs to be professionally done, and it needs to be done to the point where the court can't deny to set aside that judgment. Otherwise, that attorney is going to move forward. He's going to do an investigation of any assets, any property, any automobile, any bank accounts, and they're going to go with the garnishment and seizing your property. So they're going to enforce that judgment. She needs to set that aside first, or if possible, and you know, get some legal advice with respect to filing a bankruptcy to maybe get rid of those judgments. But it's an uphill battle after they've already obtained a judgment. And most of us, you know, and I just want to say this for the listening audience, most of us get judgments because we just don't show up. And this is why we don't show up. One, the debt collectors rely upon our conscience. And as people, as a nation, as American, I don't care if you're white, black, purple, or green, we all have a conscience. And these courts and law enforcement and everybody else depend on that conscience. That's why every time you walk in court, they got you putting your hands on the Bible. They're messing with your psyche. You know, you walk in court and they be like, well, you know you got a debt. You know you got to pay your debt. See, they start appealing to your conscience. And as normal people, we are just responsible. We might not be able to pay, but we're not liars and thieves like the societies, the legal societies, and the courts that are out there. So they depend on us to admit some sort of a guilt, okay? And what we go in there, we say, yeah, you know, yeah, I had the debt. Can I make $20 a month? You know, so if you learn anything on this show, it's like, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't recall having a debt. You need to prove it. I don't know what that spreadsheet is. I don't know what the heck that is. I don't know how you ever obtained a judgment. I never owed that party anything. They don't have any evidence. Okay, they have nothing. I just told you. The governing body agency, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, has supported everything I've promoted on this show, is that there is not very few debt collectors that can prove, okay, without a reasonable doubt, that you owe a debt, or even if you owe that debt, what amount you owe. Mm-hmm. And I just want that to resonate in your spirit and in your chakra. There is not a debt collector in this country that can prove that you owe a debt, or even if you do owe a debt, what amount you owe. Did that answer your question, sister?
Yeah. The other part of that at this point still is it can, even though there is a judgment there, can she still go after them in federal under the FDCPA?
Sure. I mean, debt collectors have a certain amount of time. I believe it's a year or two that even after a judgment, they have to maintain documentation on the alleged debt. So you still can send a debt validation dispute to, especially if you got a default judgment. But what I was about to say is most debt collectors, which are normally attorneys, they have a 95% default rate, meaning that we don't show up. Because in our minds, we're guilty of some sort of debt, so we don't show up. Being like, yeah, I owe that debt. I'm not going to go. Why don't you go? Okay? If you go and you do even the minimum things that I offer on this show, you'll be successful. Okay? You'll be very successful. So, yeah, you're going to have to go. You can send them a debt validation dispute. If they send you some rinky-dink information, and you know that rinky-dink information that they sent you is what they used in the court to get a garnishment against you and a judgment, which is totally ridiculous. You're going to let somebody invade and confiscate your property and seize your bank account over some rinky-dink information, because the same information they sent you is the same information, you know, I'm not going to say it's funny, but laughingly, it's the same information they took to a so-called judge, and the judge would be like, yeah, you know what, yeah, I think you got enough evidence for a debt. See, these courts are a joke. Because even if you're not there, when you think about the judge shacks in New York, you know, a lot of foreclosers go to New York and you see these rulings from Judge Shack where he's just obliterating these debt collectors and these mortgages. And most of the time, those rulings come from people that didn't even show up. They didn't even show up to contest the foreclosure. And he's doing his job as a judge by saying, just because they're not here don't mean I'm going to give you a $250,000 property and you can't prove you're entitled to it. That's a real judge. That's a real jurist. That's how the court systems across the country should operate. So just because you didn't show up, that debt collector still should be satisfied that judge's, okay, thirst for evidence and proof that this particular person who is not here, especially if they're not here, owes a debt, and I'm going to give you an order and a judgment that's going to subject that person to garnishment and seizure of property. That's the way it's supposed to be. These courts are supposed to uphold your rights. They're not supposed to defend it for you, but if that plaintiff is not doing its job, that court is supposed to say, you haven't proved your case, and I don't think you have enough admissible evidence or a competent fact witness to be able to, for me to determine that a debt is owed to you. All right, sister? So hopefully that helps.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Peace. All right, let's go to 267-3782, 267-3782. You are on High Frequency Radio. Welcome to the Sharif Show. Do you have a question, comment, or concern?
Yes, Islam, brother. How are you?
Islam, I'm well. How are you, mother?
I'm fine, thank you. Yes, my question is, I think on one of the shows you had mentioned in reference to alleged loans dealing with mortgage. When you get past that battle, you might not say it in these words, but it's the same thing, I guess, that you still have a risk of some other entity coming after you for taxes, such as a sure sale. Could you kind of elaborate on things we can do in reference to that?
Okay. Mother, just repeat your
just
question one more time. You said
not that I have that issue, but just in general,
okay,
to put it out there.
About taxes or about
property taxes?
I kind of want
to.
Yes. Well, probably what I referenced was the fact that, you know, you probably, if you have property, you don't want two trains coming at you simultaneously. What I mean by that is, again, when I tell my listeners and our nation, you have to pay somebody. many of us is just we saved a lot of money over the course of years by not having to pay that mortgage debt for whatever reason. We have to save some of that money. We have to use some of that money. And one thing you might consider doing so you don't have two agencies coming after you is pay your property tax. Because you can spend all your money or if you don't have any money and you can defend your foreclosure, but then you're going to be subject to a tax sale right around the corner. They're running parallel. So pay your taxes, because one of the things the debt collectors do, the ones that masquerade as lenders, is they pay your taxes and they pay forced place insurance. They're indemnifying themselves and insuring your property, and they're just a debt collector. Okay, and paying your taxes to sort of give them some interest in your property. Pay your taxes. Okay, taxes is a different issue. Pay that so you're not dealing with a foreclosure and a tax sale simultaneously or concurrently. Okay, so that's what I mentioned about taxes. You have to choose your battles. Pay your taxes. Get your own homeowner's insurance. There is nothing that stops you from getting your own homeowner policy. Okay, that's another thing I want to tell you. Get it. Insure your property. I don't care if you don't know who your lender is. I don't care what. Insure your property and pay your taxes and defend your foreclosure and invest in defending that foreclosure. No matter whether you get an attorney, or no matter whether you get a consulting group or you get a paralegal, put your money back into your property if you plan on taking it, and don't wait till the last minute. Was that answering your question, Mother, or did you have something more?
Yes, another question I have. Suppose you had a student loan and you sent them documentation in reference to verification and they just totally ignored it and just withheld your tax return. How would you address that issue?
And that's the issue that I'm informing the nation that it's happening, because your president, took over student loans and got rid of the middle people, the Sallie Mae's and all those entities, then they're going ahead and they're saying, now you owe us directly. You owe the government directly. We were funding these loans. We were the money source. We were the money bags behind the loan. And we had these other little subsidiaries going out there and conducting the transactions for us. But now you owe us directly. And are you going to argue with us? No. I mean, if you are an individual subject to the IRS and you are a taxpayer, and you operate in that capacity, then they're going to take your tax returns, and it's not much really you can do about it other than sue them. Suing the government is an uphill battle, but it can be done. But you just have to look at your documentation, and again, just like a mortgage, see who's on that documentation. If Sallie Mae purportedly made that loan, then where did you come from? Mr. Government or Fannie Mae, whoever you are, where did you come from? I just want to see whether Sallie Mae ever made that loan, because if they lied and they were a straw, okay, purchaser or buyer, then that's against the law. Truth in lending, it's a violation if you don't tell me who the true principal is, okay? So if Sallie Mae lied on that contract, okay, and said that they were the source of the funds, and I determined that they wasn't, then I have a problem, okay? No differently than you went down to a car dealership and you bought a car in your name for somebody else. That is considered illegal and a violation of federal law. That is called a straw purchase, okay? And that is illegal, all right? So if Fannie Mae or if Sallie Mae did the same thing, that's illegal and a violation of the Truth in Lending Act and some other state court claims as well. So you want to say, listen, I got a problem because I'm finding out now that you are always the money bag. And if you knew you were always the source of the funds and you had these people lying in the documentation saying that they were in order for them to get a cut of the loan proceeds, then I got a problem with that. And you have to go after them. But that's an uphill battle. And I would just say on student loans, I understand that some of us are using the education system to get those loans. Those loans are just as equally an instrument used for enslavement than the mortgage. They run neck and neck. These student loans with interest can run up to hundreds of thousands of dollars. So just consider a mortgage, you know, in interest, you're paying $300,000-$400,000. A student loan, you're paying hundreds of thousands of dollars. Taxes, you're at 39%. Property tax, you're at a certain percentage. How can we ever live if we don't start removing these economic shackles and start going on the offense and start doing some investigation and research and trying to peel back and determine who are making these loans, who's lying, who's not? All right, Mother?
Islam, thank you very much for your time. Peace.
Thank you, Mother. Peace. All right, we're going to go to 206-723098. I'm sorry, the last four, 3098. 206-3098, you're on High Frequency Radio. Welcome to Sharif Show. Do you have a question, comment, or concern?
Greetings, Brother Sharif. This is Sister Paul in Washington State.
Greetings, Sister Paul.
My question is, thank you. My greeting is, or my question is, if you are, if I am taking a debt collector to small claims court, should the debt validation letter refer to my state collection rules or to the FDCPA?
Say that one more time for me, Mom, so I can fully understand your question. You said if you're
okay,
taking a debt collector to
to small claims court, should my debt validation letter refer to my state rules or to the FDCPA?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it should be all. You should really address all three, Mother, at the same time. And if you've ever attended one of my webinars, I have a letter and format out there to how to communicate. That communication is to go in part sort of like, you know, I am a consumer pursuant to 15 U.S.C. 1692, specifically 1692A3, and you are a debt collector pursuant to 1692A6, and you're collecting a debt pursuant to 1692A5. You are not a creditor, as that term is defined, in 1692A4. And pursuant to RCW, which, and let me tell you, Mother, Washington, the revised Code of Washington laws, you have one of the strongest consumer protection laws in the country. I mean, it is actually better than the FDCPA, than the federal law. It has some substantial liability clauses in there, and you can claim a debt collector's clock, okay, up there. So, yes, it should reference your state, whatever RCW code is, and it should reference the FDCPA. And if you've pulled your credit and determined that they're reporting this alleged debt to the credit bureau, you should reference 15 U.S.C. 1681. Okay, which is the Fair Credit Reporting Act. So you want to reference all of those when you address them because I'm identifying you for who you are under federal law and under my state law. And under those three respective laws, I'm telling you to do everything that's required of you. And I don't tell them what they need to do. I don't educate them. I just say under these laws, I am disputing the alleged debt and request validation and or verification in compliance with the three aforementioned state and federal laws, and that's it. And you let them go look it up and see the time requirements to do so, what documentation is required once they receive this type of communication, and on and so forth. But you should be using that your state small claims court for your RCW, and you should be really having a good time and making some good money in the state of Washington because they have some of the best consumer protection laws in the country.
Wonderful. I did pull my credit report, and the person that, or the entity that pulled my credit was not the debt collector that's attempting to take the property now, but it is the previous pretender lender who was not the. In fact, it was originally with WaMu, and then it went to Chase, and Chase actually pulled my credit after the Dunning letter was sent.
Ah, okay. Well, I want to get into that, and I've gotten to it before, and you can Google this information. Washington Mutual, Chase never acquired any specific loans from Washington Mutual. That's been determined by a couple of Supreme Courts, Michigan, I believe Washington, don't hold me to that, and many courts throughout the country has determined that Washington Mutual never acquired any loans or specific loans from Chase Bank. So you don't owe Washington Mutual absolutely anything. And I'm going to get into my next webinar just to let the audience know my next webinar, which will be coming either this week or next week, depending on the holiday, is going to be on the FCRA and cleaning up your credit report and making money while doing so. An inquiry on your credit has to be by a creditor, okay? You will often see one of the easiest letters you can send to a debt collector is what is called an impermissible credit pull. You will often see debt collectors or debt collectors masquerading as pretender lenders or creditors. They will pull your credit. You will see that in the inquiry file. If they pull your credit, you have absolutely 2 years to bring an action. And understand this. If you want to talk about some of the sharper teeth of consumer protection laws, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, is one of them because it allows you for more damages than the FDCPA because it allows for punitive damages, and the damages are calculated on a monthly basis for each month per account per bureau. You have three bureaus, Equifax, TransUnion, and Experian. So after you dispute a debt online, electronically, or by mail, and they validate that debt, or they come back after 30 days after doing or conducting a real investigation, and they determine that the debt is yours. If they're determined to, if that debt is determined to be erroneous and it should not have been reporting to your credit, then every month that debt collector is in your credit bureau is $1,000 per bureau per account per month. Okay, so those of you that want to get on the next webinar, I will teach you how to make a good bit of money. And as well, there is a criminal provision to acquiring someone's consumer credit report, okay, without legal justification, all right? And that is 2 years in prison and a fine, okay, punishable under Title 18. All right, so it's a very serious crime for any debt collector or most times attorneys to access your credit bureau. Your credit bureau has very significant proprietary information, your Social Security, your job information, your date of birth, your credit history, your credit cards, where you live, your home, your account numbers. I mean, it's something that should be protected by all costs. And a debt collector that you haven't applied for credit and doesn't afford you any services should not be obtaining your credit report. Neither should they be reporting any information that's not accurate. They have to be accurate. If you owe $100 and they're saying you owe $120, that's a violation. They have to be precise, right, and exact. So my next webinar will be on that. That is a very good money source for us. Impermissible credit pulls, you can write that down and Google that and look into that. That is a easy thing to do when you just send a simple letter to the credit debt collector and say, on this particular date, I noticed that you made an inquiry to my credit. I need you to provide the credit application or services that you provide me that deems you appropriate to be able to access and obtain my consumer credit file. Should you not, please remit a $1,000 payment to avoid litigation. If you do not, then I will go ahead and sue you in U.S. District Court, and you will be responsible for attorney fees, costs, as well as statutory damages for the violation. You know, usually the debt collectors, they'll go ahead and just send you the check. All right, that's my experience. They're going to send you the check because, as well, you can file a criminal complaint with the FTC for them obtaining your credit report under fraudulent pretenses. So that's a very serious thing. It usually scares the hell out of, you know, any debt collector or any attorney that does that because it does hold a possible felony conviction for doing so.
Wonderful.
Okay,
My last question is, if someone has already been foreclosed upon by a debt collector, and I'm in a non-judicial state. Can one go back and retrieve their property because it was not because it was taken by a debt collector?
Sure, it's an uphill battle, but that's a wrongful foreclosure action, and yes, the courts are coming around to recognize that a lot of things and shady things have been done, and, you know, are you still in the property? Are you still in possession of something that you've already lost and moved on?
Already lost and moved on.
Okay. Yeah, I would go after them. You can do a wrongful foreclosure action. You can send them a debt validation dispute and, you know, go ahead and sue them and see if you can obtain the cost of the property. Because, again, what I tell people all the time is that really, I mean, these days you really want the cost of the property. The money is what I go for. I'm money hungry. I'm a capitalist, and I'm proud of it. I don't want the property because we all know by this time that our property values were inflated anyway. Okay, and in the foreclosure state, they're selling them for the real value it always had. So just give me the money because I can buy me two properties for the price of the inflated property that I bought several years ago. So just, you know, I don't want the property back. Go ahead and give me the value, the market value of the property or the face amount of the note, and go ahead and settle me up, and I'll go buy me three new homes. All right, so that's what you want to go after, and that is possible for you to do so, yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you so much. Be blessed, Mother. All right, we're going to take a 2 or 3 minute break. Let me go ahead and wet my mouth a little bit and I see we got a few more callers, 4 or 5 in the queue. I definitely will get to you. We have an hour left. We're going to take a short break, and I'll be right back.
Busting and you we screaming.
Deeper than words, beyond right, die for your love, beyond life, sweet as the Jesus peace, beyond ice, blind me baby with your neon lights, Ray-Ban's arm, police in sight, oh what a beautiful death, let's both wear white, if you go to heaven and they bring me to hell, just sneak out and meet me, bring a box of L. She fell in love with the bad guy, what you doing with them rad guys, them rad guys? They ain't see potential with me, girl. But you see it, if it's me or you will get the world. And so be it,
I don't care if they give me life. I get all of my life from you. And if love you had a price, I will pay my life for you.
Frequency Radio, you're on the Sharif Show. And I want to give a shout out to my constituents and my host on the show, Yusef L., Brother Savage. We're putting together a great network that's continuing to grow. We hope that everybody will continue to tune in. And speaking with the lead host, Brother Yusef, his goal and his dream is to have information flowing 24 hours a day. The brother have plans to bring you a variety of different guest speakers and guests, and he plans on giving you information regarding all type of topics, including music and things of that nature. So I just want to give props to him for having the wherewithal and the ability to be able to provide the nation with almost everything they need, what I call a Moorish Walmart experience. We're going to go back to the caller lines. We're going to start off with 609-9910, 609-9910. You're on the Sharif Show High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question, comment, or concern?
How you doing, sir? My name is Everett Jefferson. I'm actually from Williamstown, New Jersey. I had a incident occur over the weekend. It is not debt related. I was referred to you by a friend of mine who had given me your phone number and asked me to tune into the station and also just ask two questions. I wasn't sure if this was an appropriate thing to bring up at this moment, but I did feel as though you would possibly have some insight as to how I should deal with the situation. Should I continue?
Okay. I'll take a swing at it, brother. Let's see if we can help you.
Okay. Over the weekend, I had attended a 25th birthday party at a friend of mine's house. It's located on the corner of a street, and we had parked the vehicle, or he had, a friend of mine had parked the vehicle on the side of the street. Long story short, what happened was I left the party, and as I helped the gentleman who needed his oil check to check his oil, he agreed to give me a ride home. If I did that for him. I wasn't driving because my license was suspended at the time, so I didn't want to, you know, take the risk of being caught driving while suspended. So we entered the vehicle, and as the gentleman turned the key to the car of the vehicle, an officer pulled up in front of us. The officer was extremely aggressive and demanded our identification. So we refused to give it to him, and he proceeded to attempt to reach in the car, open the doors, and as he was not successful, he couldn't find the handle, so he wasn't able to open the car doors. He then threatened to break the windows and force us out the vehicle. He was literally swinging a metal baton at the windows and kind of swinging it up to the windows and like stopping it, basically trying to intimidate us more or less. We still refused to give him any ID. He then he kind of convinced the other gentleman that I was with to step out the car. So he did eventually step out the car. He questioned him, and the other gentleman gave him his ID out of the fear that, you know, this cop was going to hurt him. So the cop came around to the vehicle. He keeps on telling me to keep my hands on the dash of the vehicle. So I'm like, okay, I'm just going to, you know, sit here quietly. So that's what I did. He came up to the other side of the vehicle, asked me for my identification. I said, I don't have any identification. And he said, well, what were you reaching for when I asked for identification earlier? And because I was reaching for my ID at first, it was just a reaction. And as I thought about it, I figured I didn't have to give him any ID because we weren't doing anything wrong at the time. He had stated that he was doing an investigation, and we asked him what was the investigation for and what grounds he had for an investigation. And he had nothing to say after that. He was just saying, I was doing an investigation, and we need to just cooperate with him. So we told him that we weren't giving ID up. And at that point, I was still in the car. He came over and asked me for my ID. I refused to give him my ID. He asked for my name, and I gave him my name. So then after that, he had asked for my Social Security number, and I told him I didn't remember it. And then he said, you're 25 years old, and you don't remember your Social Security number. And I said, well, frankly, sir, I don't feel comfortable with giving you my information because I don't feel as though we are doing anything wrong. He at that point asked me to step out the vehicle. So I stepped out the vehicle without any resist or any discourse in his demand. And I put my hands up against the vehicle. At that point, he searched me. He pulled out my wallet and my cell phone. Once he pulled out my wallet and cell phone, he asked me, he said, I thought you didn't have your ID. And I said, oh, I guess I do. At that point, he had radioed in. I think he did it before. He had, when he had my information as far as my name, he had radioed in asking about me more or less. And I had a warrant for my arrest for a traffic ticket, for the unpaid traffic ticket that I had for driving while suspended. So unfortunately, I was in the wrong at that point, as far as me having a warrant. So at that time, he had arrested me and put me in the back of the squad car. He then went over to the other gentleman who was in the vehicle, and I'm not sure what exactly happened between them, but he proceeded to, I guess the other gentleman gave him permission to search the vehicle. He then searched the vehicle, and he found nothing in the vehicle. He was basically insinuating that we had weapons or drugs beforehand, and he had found no weapons, no drugs, no nothing that would incriminate us or even make us seem as if we had anything.
All right, caller, let me cut you a little bit short, because we could only take a short question. I don't deal with traffic issues, but this is what I will say to you. I don't waste a whole lot of time trying to educate law enforcement officers. They've been educated on what they feel they can do within the contents of commerce. Now, I don't know if at the time you were in a regulatable activity. You said yourself you were driving. Driving is an occupation, okay? And it's an occupation that requires licensing if you were driving. Now, I don't think you were driving or even your friend was driving, but I don't know if you were driving a truck or a track trailer or a dump truck or a taxi or a limousine. I don't know what you were driving, but you indicated to me that you were in commerce just by using the mere term driving. Second of all, a police officer does have the authority to ask of you anything they want to. Now, I didn't say you had to answer that, And I didn't say the law requires you to answer, but they will always tell you they have the authority to request of you anything, and they might be able to support that with law, saying that the law requires that I ask you for your driver's license. Do you understand what that statement says?
Yes.
Do you know what that means?
Is that, I do, but in the event that I wasn't...
Okay, well, tell me what do you think that means when... Well, listen to me. Tell me what that means to you when a law enforcement individual says, the law says I have the right to ask you for a driver's license and identification. Tell me to you what that means.
That means that an officer can ask me for my identification.
Right, but does that mean that you have to give it to them?
No.
That's not what the law says. Now, if you are in a regulatable activity and you were doing commerce in the form of driving, then the law definitely requires, and listen to my words, requires you to have a driver's license if you're driving.
The point that you're missing is that I was not – the car was not in motion.
I understand that. No, I clearly understand you wasn't driving. But what I'm saying is when the driver, who you said was driving, failed to identify himself.
He wasn't driving the vehicle.
He wasn't driving. Who was driving?
Nobody was driving. We had just entered the vehicle.
You had just entered the vehicle. Okay, so you wasn't driving.
Literally,
but there's a presumption that – right. Gotcha. All right, that's something that you need to – go ahead and address tomorrow's show at 11 o'clock on USEF. He will be able to give you more direction and instructions on that. I'm sorry I didn't want to dive into it, but
hey,
my show is about debt collection.
Brother Sheree.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Brother Sheree. Hey, what's going on? I was listening.
Hey,
is it okay if I chime in and on that real quick?
Hey, help
this,
yourself.
Some important information the listeners may want to understand. First of all, you have to understand that police can only conduct what is called a Terry frisk. You have to understand what a Terry frisk is, because what that is that's called an illegal search and seizure. And they have a thing called the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine. All right? A police officer can only search you for weapons, all right, in order for his protection. He cannot take anything out of your pocket. What you need to do is you need to put together an affidavit stating what has happened and state what happened, you know, point by point. And file it. It will be very effective if you do that. But a police officer cannot go in your pockets, take out your wallet, take out anything. I want all the listeners to understand that the only thing a police officer can do is pat you down, especially if you have not been suspected of a crime. And that's the first question you should ask him, have I been suspected of a crime? And you did not need to get out of the car. If you hadn't been, the first thing you should have did is told him to call a supervisor. I had a situation happen to me. I was in South Carolina, and I was driving a Mercedes-Benz. I was coming from a wedding, and I just pulled into a hotel parking lot. And a white cop drove by and looked at me, and I hadn't been in – we had just parked back in the car. I was in a hotel, and he looked in the car, and then he turned around and pulled in front of the car and hit the lights on us. And then he walked up to my car, and this is what he said to me. He said, we've been having a lot of drug activity in this area. Can I get your driver's license? I said, excuse me, sir, are you presuming that because I'm driving a Mercedes-Benz, a black man driving a Mercedes-Benz, that I have to be engaged in some type of criminal activity? I said, let me have your business card and call your supervisor. I said, I'm a businessman, and I'd like to get your business card, and I'd like you to call your supervisor right now. And I never gave him ID or anything like that and stared the shit out of him. Because the first thing I want to do is when I ask them for the business card is I want to get their name. I want his name. All right? That's the first thing you always get from these individuals because there's going to be some liability attached for any type of encroachment on any of the constitutionally protected rights. And you have a right to privacy. Now, what Brother Sharif is saying that you're driving, when somebody asks you, you tell them that you're traveling. Driving is a regulated activity, but you got to understand what that word driver means. Taxi driver, bus driver, truck driver, ambulance driver, limousine driver. These are individuals that are engaged in some sort of commercial activity for gain. You cannot use the public highways for private gain. And if you're not using the public highways for private gain, you are not engaged in any type of commercial activity. therefore they don't have any right to come and ask you anything. Now, there's an operational presumption that you are engaged in commercial activity because you have license plates on the car, you have a registration, right, and you have a driver's license. But what he did to you is called illegal search and seizure, and you need to have mood to have that dismissed. Because just look up Terry Frist. It's called Terry Frist and Fruit of the Poisonous Tree Doctrine. Terry Frist. Terry Frisk. They can do a Terry Frisk on you.
Oh, okay.
Called Terry Frisk. T-E-R-R-Y Frisk. F-R-I-S-K. That means that the police, all they can do is when they get out the car and they search you, all they're supposed to be searching you for is for weapons for their own protection. That is it. And that's what will be going. I don't care if you got a key in your pocket. If it doesn't
right.
feel like
let
a
me,
gun,
let me say this. Let me say
out.
This to you as well. Let me say this to you as well. Mm-hmm. I don't promote engaging negatively with any law enforcement official. If you have a cause of action, let that law enforcement officer do his job. And from what you're telling me, you knew you had a warrant or you had some sort of liability to a state or you failed to appear in some particular matter. I believe your behavior probably was very, you know, avoidance in nature. And the officer suspected that there was something going on in the way that you were acting. And once he investigated, he determined that you had a warrant, you were pretty much not complying, and you were resisting or rejecting in a way that, you know, normal people don't. If you're driving, if you got a problem with an officer, let him go ahead and do his job, take that ticket, listen to USEP's show, and dispose of that ticket. Or if the behavior is egregious enough, file your suit against the officer in the city or state or police department that he represents for some sort of a violation. You notice USEP said you're constitutionally protected, right? He didn't say constitutional rights. And I hate when people say, I got constitutional rights. You don't have constitutional rights. You have constitutionally protected rights. Constitution has nothing to do with you. It keeps the government in check. Okay? So, you know, I just, you know, continue to study. You had a legitimate warrant out there. So you had some obligation to some state or some court. And, you know, you're going to have an uphill battle being able to get out of that. And you raise the officer's suspicion by, you know, and now you were a passenger. Did you have to identify yourself? You should have gave him your name. Okay, Social Security number. I don't know if I would have given that. I don't have one, so I don't use one. But, you know, you could have done a variety of things, gave your name, and kept it rolling. I mean, okay, all right. So I'm going to move on because I got some other questions with a pertinent topic to debt on this call. I appreciate your call. Tune in to USEP, you know, Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. I don't know when Brother Savage is on, but he'll be able to definitely go more deeper with you about that matter. Appreciate you calling. All right, we're going to go to 240-3273, 240-3273. You're on High Frequency Radio. Welcome to the Sharif Show. Can I help you?
Hey, that is me. Salam alaikum, my brother.
Salam, brother.
Hey, listen, I called 3 weeks ago, and I probably didn't articulate the question the way I wanted to, but it was one other thing that happened like a few days later, and it involves my summary judgment that I did not attend. And the reason why I didn't attend is because I didn't have all the information. I wasn't confident, and I figured I'd address it at a later time. But true or false, when the title company gets involved with a, you know, when you sign for a land or a home, and the title company gets involved, are they the instrument that actually takes the house back away from you? Because once your signature is on a mortgage, so-called mortgage, that is your house. But once the title company gets involved, it reverses itself back to the bank?
No, I think you're a little bit confused. On a title company just vets title. Their job is to search the UCC records, which is a Uniform Commercial Code, search the property records, and make a determination whether, first of all, who owns title. And there's also an entity that most of us can use when we're going after these debt collectors and pretender lenders is to spend $200 or $300 and get a title search, because they're able to a lot of times pull up things, whether the bank is in noncompliance with Uniform Commercial Code, whether they filed the appropriate documentation in the UCC, and they're able to pull up your title history. And many times one of the questions that we ask lenders is provide a chain of title. And you can obtain that from a title search company. So, no, title search company is only going to vet title if you're buying a property or if the bank is about to do a loan on property. They'll do a title search to determine whether the property is clear or free and clear to be able to make that transaction or change ownership. So they have nothing to do with changing your title or anything. They either work for a lender or if a homeowner hires them to do a search on the property to determine whether there are any encumbrances or anything of that nature on the property.
Okay, is it safe to say that once the bank gets your signature, they're supposed to deposit at the treasury and supposed to be paid for? Is that true or false?
Nah, brother, that sounds like some Patriot stuff. I mean, I don't get into it. I don't subscribe to all those things. Listen, I don't care how the bank create the money. You know, you have the house. Bottom line is that you have the house, whether they created it out of thin air or created it in the basement. I really don't care. I just want to make sure the proper person that I'm paying or the proper person coming after me is entitled to be paid. I don't care how you create the money. I don't care where it goes. I don't care what the treasury. I haven't had or know anyone that's had success with that. And I just use law. That's all I use, and I'm able to do what I do based on that.
Okay, quickly, is a land foreclosure a little bit different than a full house foreclosure? Because it seems like mine is almost like a credit card in judgment. Whereas somebody, like I say, I just found out after I called the show the first time, found out a couple of days later when I called the bank, they changed the name of the bank, and then they said that they sold my note to somebody else. And I got a letter saying that they need me to pay the taxes on it. I guess I got to the end of the year or something like that. But is a land a little bit different from a home foreclosure as how they go about it or the end result of it?
No. I mean, they're going to foreclose on land, on a parcel, on a piece of property, the same way they're going to foreclose on a home. I mean, usually when you buy a property, they have you deed the land with the property. So it's usually owned the same. Like, you can't have land owned by one person and the house that lays upon it owned by another. So it's no different. If you have a lot that you own and you don't pay payments on that piece of parcel, then they're going to foreclose in the same manner. It's the same thing, same procedure, same process.
The summary judgment. So I missed the summary judgment hearing, and that's a foreclosure or a judgment?
Summary judgment is a judgment. Summary judgment means the plaintiff or the defendant had determined that there were no issues of facts, okay, in dispute, and that there was no need for trial, and that they want summary judgment, okay, without the need of a trial, saying that you haven't defended your case or if you're the plaintiff, that you haven't proved your case. And summary judgment, if you missed that, means that judgment was entered. Just because they file summary judgment, the court has to rule on the summary judgment. If you miss that, then that's a very important and significant part of the litigation you shouldn't have missed. So unless you missed that and you filed you a bankruptcy to stop everything, and if you didn't, you probably need to do so before summary judgment is entered or after, and you need to consult an attorney, a bankruptcy attorney, and see if you can go ahead and transfer that litigation to the bankruptcy court and start to initiate some sort of a defense or offense.
Okay, but now I'm just recently finding out, though, now that, you know, banks use their own attorneys for the most part, right? You know, it's usually the same guy, because I've seen the guy that before that sent me a curative default,
right? Yeah, foreclosure mills. Yeah,
okay,
they got accounts, you know, one attorney.
I'm just recently finding out. I mean, you know, I'm not sure if this is new news to anybody, but there's no congressional enactments, no legislative enactment that gave the bar attorney any power to do anything like that. No,
I think you're focusing on a lot of other things. You know, an attorney, I don't care if it was the president or the Congress or an attorney or a debt collector or a bank. You come after me about a debt, you getting whipped. So I don't care. I really don't care whether you're licensed to practice law, whether you have a dues card, whether you're. I don't fear any debt collector, especially any attorneys. So
what about,
I don't care
what about
who it is. An attorney
myself,
can.
Though?
An attorney can collect the debt from you if you allow him, but the law says and the FDCPA says that if he's represented in a debt collector and his regular course of business is collections of debt, then he falls under the same governing laws as the debt collector he represents. So what does it matter? He can come in there because let me tell you something. I want as many defendants as I can get. Okay, and I want them to line up because I'm telling you right now, the attorneys make the biggest mistakes. They're the ones bringing the action. They're the ones that bake the cake and put the ingredients in it to serve it to the court and give them slices and hope that they eat it and digest it and give them a judgment. So, you know, when he comes in there and he says something offline or he says something that's not supported by documentation or admissible evidence, he's going to be one of the ones that's going to dig in his pocket and write me a check. So I'll take them all, bar attorneys, bank representatives. I don't care who they are. I don't care what kind of license you have. Do you have a checkbook? And do you have a license of some sort? Because if you have a license, then I know you're restricted in many ways. And if you have a license, you have 100 rules of what you can do and what you can't do. And me, Brother Sharif, is going to find a few of them that you violated and have to pay me for. So, brother,
okay,
forget about whether the closed unit shot. Listen to what I'm saying. Forget about all that stuff. You just need to focus your energy on who's a debt collector and who not and whether they can prove a debt. I don't give a damn about anything else. That's my personal opinion. And I think you mixing that in and convoluting everything by saying, you know, they can't do this, an attorney can't do that, the court is going to allow him to come in there and represent a debt if you're not good enough to say that there is no debt. Somebody got to be a server. Somebody got to come serve you the food, okay? I don't care if the server is not good or not. Can you bring me a plate? I want the debt collector to bring me a plate. And if that plate's not right, then I'm going to be suing you, you and the manager and anybody else who sent you. You follow me?
Okay, so now that I have a summary judgment that I didn't get to, you're saying now that my only option is bankruptcy.
I'm not saying that. Again, this is just my opinion. An option is bankruptcy, or you need to appeal to that court, try to set aside judgment or proffer before the court a reason, show cause why you didn't attend that summary judgment hearing or you didn't respond. The fact that you're telling me you know you had a summary judgment tells me that at some point you either involved in the litigation or privy to the fact that litigation was ongoing against you. So, I mean, you got to do something, brother. I don't have a snapshot of everything that you need to do.
I didn't have the confidence to go in at the time.
I understand.
I'm just going to deal with it at a later date.
Right. But you need to listen to every one of my shows, and you will be able to gain some confidence. And it's real simple, brother. Do you owe that person a debt? Not whether you owe somebody else a debt. Prove that I owe you money or where you lent me money or where I applied for or obtained services from you that resulted in a debt. If you don't have that and all you have is hearsay and a spreadsheet or some documentation that you piece together, that is not enough or suffice for you to gain any judgment in your favor for an alleged debt that you can't prove. As simple as that.
As you mentioned earlier in your show, how much is your webinar, brother?
The webinars, usually I keep them, you know, we try to keep them in around 150, and they usually stay around there. If you get on the email list, email me at thelawmaster44@yahoo.com. You'll be apprised of the next one coming up probably this week or next week. And I also have two that's already out there that you should just go ahead and obtain for that same donation amount, and that will give you some fundamental basis and increase your confidence. And like I said, it's not easy. You know, I try to, and the responses that I get is that, you know, Brother Sharif, you keep it real. You keep it on a very easy to ascertain level. And that's what I try to do, is to keep it real and keep it very simple, because your consumer protection laws are designed and were built for protection for the least sophisticated consumer. And that's how the law wrote it, that it's for people that don't have a lot of legal experience, that don't have a lot of legal knowledge. They are supposed to understand the debt that they are presumed to owe. And if you don't make me understand it on a bubble level, okay, on a high school level, then I can't defend myself, and I can't defend myself, then I definitely can't determine whether I owe you something. So when you're dealing with attorneys, again, the best thing to do, because a lot of them are very articulate, or some of them have the ability to water things down to where the least sophisticated consumer can understand. Mr. Attorney, you wrote all this fancy stuff, and you're using all those fancy words. This is just what you say, because this is extrapolated out of the FDCPA. Sir, I'm just a least sophisticated consumer. What you're saying is that I'm just as dumb as a bag of rocks when it comes to legal matters. Can you explain to me how I owe you this debt and where this debt came from and what evidence you may have? And, you know, because I understand you're talking real fancy to the judge and the judge is understanding, but in order for you to get a judgment against me, I have to understand. So, Judge, I don't understand anything this attorney is saying. I don't understand what debt he's talking about. I don't know how I owe him the debt. You see what I mean? Real simple, like, you can write that or you can verbally articulate that.
Okay. Until I get to that closed shop. I'm still able to pay the taxes on it, and that'll buy me some time, is what you're saying.
Okay, brother. Well, you know what? You know, I know you want to style it. Yeah, I know you want to style it a closed shop, but, you know, I do pretty well. My students do pretty well in those closed shops, because it could be a closed shop long as the cash register is open. I need a check.
Okay.
All right, brother Pete.
Sounds good. All right.
All right, we're going to go back to... Let's take a caller from 1111. 1111. You're on High Frequency Radio. Welcome to the Sharif Show. Do you have a question, comment, or concern?
Hello?
Hello. You're on the air.
Oh, you can hear me?
I sure can.
Okay, then, because it said 111. I don't know if that was me or not.
Yeah, that's you, brother. That's how it came up. I don't know if you're on Skype or on the Internet or something like that, but your number didn't come up. It came up all once. What's your question?
Well, I got a couple of them, so I guess you can figure out which one you want to answer. I got one dealing with the these foreclosure complaints. One is capacity. One is stating the cause of action and tax collected attorney. So it could be any of the three that you want to answer.
You pick whatever question is most important to you, but let's get it rolling, because I got about five more questions to get to, and we got 30 minutes left. So you pick the question that's most relevant and important to you.
Okay, then how about in these foreclosure complaints where it says failing to state a cause of action, and from what I'm understanding, these complaints are all allegations. There's really no... The cause of action is what? Is the cause of action a contract, a breach of contract? Because really, most of these foreclosure complaints are real vague. You know, they really don't state no facts. It just, you know,
sure.
It's all like presumption.
Sure.
So
you use the right word. It's hearsay. It's presumptions. They're allegations. And that's what they are. Cause of action is what you're pleading as a damage. Okay, a cause of action is a violation of the FDCPA. That may be a cause of action, okay? That is a pleading. That is a damage. Or you violated the FCRA. That's a cause of action. Or you failed to pay a mortgage, or a breach of contract, which is what they usually claim in a foreclosure. So a cause of action, is it a damage? What's your pleading? What's the harm? What's the action that you're asking the court to relieve you from? All right, and you're absolutely right that most of them are vague because, again, they depend on your conscience. They want you to run in there and start talking subject matter before you identify and use rules of procedure procedurally, okay, saying that, you know, you come in with a motion to dismiss, a motion to strike, a demur, this information was written on upon information and belief. Information and belief cannot invoke the subject matter of this court. This person is a debt collector. The complaint is not supported by any admissible evidence or competent fact witness or an affidavit or declaration that supports the hearsay statements within the four corners of the complaint. You know, these are things that you can say. Deny. I deny. I don't know who this person is. You put a notice of dispute on the record, and you ask them to prove the debt, and you move the court to dismiss with prejudice because, you know, they have no capacity or standing to bring such action, and therefore they haven't invoked the subject matter jurisdiction of the court.
Okay, well, the question, I guess the question I'm basically asking is, if they're saying it's a contract dispute, okay, and they always, like you were speaking before, they'll always bring up all these public records, okay, but then if it's a contract dispute, they never bring up the contract that makes them, you know, that you owe them money. Like, if you go to your closing, you'll have, like, the alleged lender, and you'll have, you know, you have an alleged lender there. But whenever you get these assignment of mortgages, it will say Deutsche Bank Trust, which is basically a certificate. So at that point, if it's a contract dispute, where is it? They never bring a contract that you have with this Deutsche Bank Trust acting as Morgan Stanley, and it will say attorney in fact will be the servicer. And it's attorney in fact also, that means like, power of attorney. They never present the contract or this power of attorney. So,
sure.
One, you know, if they're saying, you know, if you're filing for a motion to dismiss for failing to state a cause of action, because they never state a cause of action in none of these complaints. There's never
okay.
New.
Well, let me ask you a question. I just told the last brother, is who are you? You are a least sophisticated consumer, right? You're going to follow all those disco lights that these attorneys and these banks throw out there, and they want you to have a club-like atmosphere. They want you to be all over the place looking at all those pretty lights blinking. It's Christmas time. They want to talk about, you know, assignments and power of attorney. And so you already told me, you already gave me the indication that your loan was definitely securitized by mere reference of Morgan Stanley, okay? Morgan Stanley is bankrupt. Okay, so we all know that it was securitized. So what you do is sue under the FDCPA and say, I don't understand any of this hogwash that they're talking about, assignments and power of attorneys and attorney in facts and Deutsche Bank. I don't know who these parties are. I never had an agreement with them. I have no contract that was executed by me. I do not recognize the account number. I need evidence and admissible evidence along with competent fact witnesses that will substantiate these allegations. Other than that, it's just mere hearsay and a story that they just concocted attempting to mislead the court and the defendant and or plaintiff into thinking some debt is owed. Brother, you're not going to follow all that because you're not putting them in their place. You're not putting them in their lane. Let's get out of the fancy talk. What's the lane? The lane for mortgagees and creditors and lenders is very complex. You will get lost. You will drown, okay, in the information you just told me. But let's go ahead and identify them. If the assignment was done while you were in default, they're a debt collector. And what do I teach? The FDCPA is 10 pages, the meat of it is, long, and you can definitely ask questions within the FDCPA and say, I'm a least sophisticated consumer. I am a consumer pursuant to 1692A3. You're collecting a debt pursuant to 1692A5. You're not a creditor that I know of pursuant to 1692A4, and you are a debt collector from 1692A6. This is evidence in your assignment where you assigned the alleged debt while it was allegedly in default. Now, what have you just done? You've parked them in the lane you want them to be in and say, now slow down with all that old fancy talk and that assignment and power of attorney and all that old crap, all them disco lights, turn the lights off, stop the music, DJ. Who the hell are you? Talk to me in layman's terms because I'm a least sophisticated consumer pursuant to the FDCPA. Tell me in plain English who the hell you are and what authority you have to come after me about this debt. You see what I just did? If you don't do that, it's sort of like, you know, my kids come to me sometime and I will ask them a question and they'll give me a long answer dancing all around the bush, behind the house, all behind the school bus. And when they answer that question like that as parents and adults, the first thing you'd be like, okay, let me ask you this question one more time. Let me get a direct answer. This is my question. Don't answer a question I didn't ask you. Answer this question because you're giving me a very long answer that's dodging the essence of the question. So you just want to do that with the debt collector, with the attorney, with the bank. Answer this question in simple English. Are you a creditor? And do I owe you money? These are setup questions. These are authentic questions. Do I owe you money? No. Okay, so I don't owe you money, but you're saying I owe somebody else money who's not around to substantiate or support what you're saying, right? So you are a debt collector, right, sir? Okay, got you. See, that's what Brother Sharif taught me on the FDCPA. You're a debt collector, right? Okay, the FDCPA allows me to talk to you in Pookie terms, in Uncle Bubba terms. I need you to make me understand what debt you say that I owe. You see what I mean?
Yes, sir.
And that's how you qualify them, brother. Until you qualify them and corner them and position them to where you can speak with them candidly, they will continue to lose you in all this legalese talk and all this complicated mortgage talk and all this complicated deed of trust talk and everything else. That's not where you want to be. The lane that I provide for my listeners is the FDCPA and your state consumer protection laws. All right, brother? Got to go to the next question. Hopefully that helps. If not, give me an email and we'll go further. All right. Let's go to 856-9755, 856-9755. You're on High Frequency Radio.
Hey, 9755.
Show.
Peace. Hey, how's it going? This is Brother Q. We have correspondence. I've been corresponding for you with a little while.
All right.
You know, out of New Jersey. You know, first, like I said, you know, I just want to give thanks, you know, for what you guys are putting on. You know, I had dialogue with Brother Youssef, Adiba, actually, you know, when I was going through my whole court case and things like that. He was like, you know, you got to get on this, you know, get plugged in with our Brother Youssef. And, you know, so now, you know, I'm pretty far advanced in a lot of things. Well, the first thing I wanted to ask you was, like I said, when I deal with clients and when I deal with teaching, you know, I teach seminars and different things like that, I go after the depth approach. I apologize. I'm in class right now trying to get my thoughts together. But I go after the identity theft. So,
sure.
And, you know, in my correspondence, I was wondering if that was the proper approach, because that's the approach I take. I take identity theft. These individuals, you did not authorize them to use your credit information. You know, you never had a contract with these individuals, so it's identity theft. And then the second thing I go after is the data furnishers, sending off letters, to data furnisher letters. So I was wondering, you know, if you do the same approach as far as identity theft.
Sure. I mean, identity theft is one of the things, and if those who was in my webinar, you know, and I sent them a sample complaint, you know, one of those causes of action I may plead is identity theft if I have an impermissible credit pull or they're reporting erroneous information to a credit bureau,
okay.
To the credit report. I will use identity theft. I will also, again, as I identify and qualify as my you know, fundamental teachings, identify and qualify who are you,
mm-hmm.
how did you obtain my information?
Sure.
And that's a question regarding identity. How did you obtain that information? Well, you had a debt with so-and-so. Okay, well, show me how you obtained that information and what are you doing? Because what people have to understand is that I don't know how many times we look on TV and the Internet and hear about these breaches of credit information and social security numbers, you know, they happen at these big agencies. I think there were MasterCard and Visa had breaches where, you know, millions of consumers, you know, account numbers and social security numbers were breached. I mean, millions. So what you have to understand is that many of these collection agencies, they employ a lot of felons and rehabilitated drug and alcohol users, or maybe rehabilitated or not, and they're sitting there with all your proprietary information, social security number, credit report, and everything. So you do have a cause of action for identity theft if you're suing. And I will throw that in if there's a breach of that credit report or they're reporting information erroneously. So that's not a bad cause of action to plead and to go at and to pursue.
So I'm saying, like, when you're dealing with, I'm not saying, because I haven't sued yet, because, you know, the process has been effective. So I haven't, you know, had to take it on that extent to sue. Like I said, the first application that I do is I just send out the FTC affidavits on identity.
Not
theft.
Affidavit, brother. I don't promote, nor do I subscribe to. We misuse affidavits, and I know affidavit.
I'm not saying a sworn affidavit. I'm saying like the FTC. FTC just basically on identity theft and
okay.
Notary.
Okay, the affidavit filled out with FTC when you're filing a complaint.
That's one of my triggers,
man, because I hear a lot of people say, I sent the debt collector or the bank an affidavit.
No.
You're not in court. They're going to look at you and say, oh, this is one of these guys. You can do the FTC and report the identity theft. You know, the FTC gets millions of those, just like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. You know, I don't depend on those governmental agencies to do anything for me, but it is good to file that. But you have to be careful filling out affidavits and make sure they're right, just and exact. But everybody is going to develop their own style, and I'm not going to say the way you're going about it is wrong. I don't give the debt collectors a lot of information. I demand what I want from them. I don't tell them how they need to answer that, what the time limits are, what the law says regarding how they are to respond or service me on those issues. I keep it real vague because I want them to do the research and I want them to slip. So, I don't give them a whole lot of ammunition. I do two paragraphs, brother, in the letter. This is what I need from you under this law, and that's it.
Okay. Yeah, this is what I'm saying, that the, when I teach or whatever, I just teach on, like, I haven't really been dealing with the debt collectors. I deal with the credit reporting agencies. So with dealing with the credit reporting agencies, I send the FTC affidavits out to the credit reporting agencies with a cover letter. And identification, and then they come back and they submit whatever, and then I've created a validation letter, validating the debt under 623s and United States Code or in the 15 United States. So that's what I was saying.
Let me say this to you, and I have to get on because we have quite a few more callers. We only got 18 minutes left in the live stream. If you want to call in, all callers, call in 424-222-5250. Once the live stream ends in 16 minutes and 30 seconds, we're going to continue the show for anywhere up to an hour and continue to take your questions. Those who are logged in, just make sure you're logged in and you continue to listen. But let me say this about identification. We have to be careful, about who we send identification to. And you have to understand that the credit bureaus are just private entities, like the Department of Motor Vehicles, like any debt collector. You should not be sending the credit bureau jack bone. Do you understand? Yeah. You send them a copy. They will always ask you, too. You dispute something on the credit, and they'll say, well, we need a copy of your Social Security card to verify your identity, or we need a utility bill, or we need a copy of your driver's license. You don't need that, because if y'all haven't figured out yet, the credit bureaus make money off selling your information, and they will sell your information as quick as they will sell anything else. Your driver's license, but they need your driver. What are you going to send a debt collector or a credit reporting agency a copy of your driver's license? Are you driving in the credit bureau? They don't need that information. I basically tell you I'm disputing that information. Remove it. And if you don't remove it, because I'm who I am, I'm going to sue. I'm all about suing when you don't do what I tell you to do. So never send them any copy of anything. If you dispute it and you say, that's not my address, that's not how my name is spelled, that's not this, and they say, well, send us proof, I don't have to prove anything to you. You're reporting erroneous information about me, and if you continue to do that and I told you not to, I don't owe it to you to prove anything to you. I don't know who gave you that information. You're reporting that information to the world without me substantiating it. I didn't confirm that. You didn't ask me before you reported that information. So why are you asking me for all this proof? Because the person that you're making money off of, the person that you're reporting this information is telling you, hey, that's wrong. My name is not spelled like that. That's the wrong address. That's my wrong employment. Now you got to vet me, but you're not vetting the credit furnishers, which is the debt collectors. You're not vetting the information they're reporting to you. So I have a problem with that. So never do that. Never provide them with anything. But what I also tell people, and I'll just say to you, is that I don't want them to remove the information out the credit bureau. I really don't. Wow. I make money off the information that's in there. I don't – listen, you're going to delete it after I sue you. I know that's going to come off, so I need to do two things. I don't just want the information removed. I want the – I'm going to get the information removed. I want your paycheck for you reporting it. And then once I get your paycheck, you're going to remove it, okay, because I've already gotten money out of you for reporting the erroneous information. So when cleaning up credit, you can clean your credit up if you don't want to make any money, but because the credit report is filled with money for you, I would leave all, I would dispute the information just for the purpose of seeing who's going to be dumb enough to stay in the account in the credit bureau after I dispute it. And it's those people that need to get the checkbook out, because if you're in there and you're not supposed to be in there, after I dispute it, I'm coming after you. All right, brother. Wow. I got to run to the next call, but I appreciate your calling.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, we got 13 minutes left. I got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Oh, my goodness. All right, I'm going to try to get to everybody best I could. Bear with me. We'll continue going as long as we need to get to everybody. All right, let me see where I left off now. 975. All right, let's go to 404 down to
Internet
Georgia. 404-1031. Welcome to High Frequency Radio. Go ahead and turn your radio down, brother. Got a lot of background noise.
I'm sorry, but I got my mother on the speakerphone.
Okay. Well, you got some volume going on that's reverberating.
No, I'm getting ready to cut it off.
Okay.
Okay. I have my mother on her speakerphone, and I'm listening to you at the same time on my phone.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Peace.
But
what's
how
your
you
question,
doing,
brother
Sharice?
I'm doing great, brother.
Good. A couple of questions, real quick. The insurance. I stopped paying my insurance, and I stopped paying my mortgage, and then I went to my insurance company, Allstate, and told them to remove Bank of America off my a policy, and they wouldn't do it.
That's right.
So I had to close up. I had to close up my insurance.
There you go.
So
you will have that problem
now,
many times. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right. So I'm just trying to find out how do you get insurance? Well, because they saying if you got a lien, allegedly lien on your property, then you cannot get insurance by yourself. It has to do with it has to be with the person that got a lien on your property.
I never heard that, brother. I got plenty of clients that have insurance on their property. Insurance don't give a doggone who you know how you going to pay them. And you have to understand the insurance company's biggest client, okay, is the banks.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of times you will have problems. You have to report them to the state insurance commission, because a lot of times these insurance companies are saying that the parties that are insured and indemnified, these banks don't even own the loans because assignments don't line up with, you know, the insurance companies. These insurance companies just continue to report maybe Chase when the loan has already been assigned to someone else. And how can Chase be indemnified and insured on the property when it's sold to a REMIC or a securitization trust or it's been sold over to Citibank? So they never run parallel. The information is always erroneous. And you have to understand that if you're trying to do anything with that policy, you're not paying that policy. They're paying that policy. You get your own insurance. You call them and they say it's a lien holder. I don't have a legal lien holder. You don't have one. You want to insure your property, and you can.
Well, okay, what you're probably talking about the insurance, the presumed insurance, whatever you call it, was that they illegally put on your property. I'm not talking about
forced place insurance.
Forced place insurance. I'm not talking about forced place insurance. I'm talking about the insurance that you started off in the closing of your house before your loan got sold off and everything else. The original
PMI
loan
insurance?
That you had.
You talking about PMI insurance?
Right. The insurance that you had when you closed on your house.
You had homeowners insurance.
You got escrow set up and all that.
Right. You have homeowners insurance. That's what it is. It's a homeowner's policy.
Right.
You
right,
can go and get your own homeowner's policy, brother.
Right, with that insurance that's already on your house, right through the closing of your house.
What I'm telling you is that if you're trying to make some sort of alteration or modification to your current homeowner's policy that's not being paid by you, You can't make those changes. Their loyalty is to who's paying them, and if that bank is paying them, then they're not going to sit up there and take someone off that's paying them. Although it's for your property, what? They're using your name. Listen to me, brother. They're not going to change that for you. You need to get your own insurance policy because you're not paying for that insurance.
I understand that. But my question is, do you have to have the insurance that came with the closing of your house along
I'm telling you no. Because, I mean, okay. If I have insurance with GEICO, and then I go and I get State Farm and say, oh, I want to get an additional policy. Or if I got a life insurance policy with Kemper, I can go ahead and get a life insurance policy from someone else. Okay, it doesn't matter. When I call Kemper, I was like, look, I want a life insurance policy. They don't matter. Do you have insurance anywhere else? You know, it doesn't matter. I'm willing to pay you for insurance. Okay, so you can get your own homeowner's insurance is what I'm telling you. Forget about the policy that was enforced when you took the loan out. Okay? The lender has the right to go ahead and indemnify what they consider their interest in your property.
Okay, first insurance is closed out, then that means you can go get your own insurance.
Brother, forget about the first policy is what I'm telling you. That's not your policy. I don't care if it's closed or open. I have no allegiance to any debt collector that wants to indemnify the property. That's my property. My name is on it. I am going to get insurance that in the event something happens to my property, it indemnifies and covers me, not the debt collector. Forget about that policy. It's not yours. You're not paying for it. You have no authority to change or make any changes to it because you're not writing a check for it.
But it's our escrow.
If you can go and get the escrow, brother, that the debt collector left, good luck. I mean, I'm pretty good. I haven't gotten any escrow. There is no escrow. What you want to do is get rid of the loan, okay?
Well, I'm not saying to get the escrow. I'm saying that account is set up under the escrow in our name, correct?
Yes, but how is that helping you?
I mean, because
so let me ask you a question. How are you going to
under our name?
Well, you and I would agree. You have an escrow. That's a reserve, right? So escrow is a reserve, right, for something that in case there was some damages or in case you missed a payment. Now, if you're in default a year or two, what do you think happened to the escrow? You think you're going to have a cubby account or a slush fund, and they're not going to dip into that when you're in default? You think they're going to take that money? You say, hey, listen, I'm behind on my payments 2 years. Send me that money in the escrow so I can catch up. That escrow is gone. You need to listen to me,
okay,
brother. You need to forget about everything that has to do with that. You're not going to benefit from an escrow or an insurance policy from one of these debt collectors. I just told you, you need to get your own insurance policy.
I know. I'm only asking these questions because Allstate told me that they would not let me get my own insurance with them because Bank of America had an alleged lien on my property. So I want to know. That's why I want to know if I can go to somebody else. Are they going to say the same thing Bank of America said? Allstate said.
Sure. If they ask you, well, yeah, I got a lien with Bank of America. If they say, well, you have a lien. No, I don't have a lien. Ma'am, do you have? Listen to what I'm saying, brother. Yeah, let me finish my sentence. Okay, I don't care.
The public record is not evidence.
They may go by that public record, but you have to say, I want to indemnify my property. I have an issue or maybe have pending litigation. I don't know who the lender is. Meanwhile, I want to indemnify and insure my property in case of any loss. That's all, brother. I'm trying to tell you. I mean, you can be excited about it. I'm trying to tell you what has been done. I'm not guessing. All
right,
brother?
Right. Well,
I appreciate your call. Sure.
Excuse me. Can I just a little bit more? Because I hardly ever get on these calls because my call gets dropped and everything. So I cannot enforce that law on the insurance company if they decide to go by public record and not go by my word, right?
Right. You need to contact your state insurance commission and say, listen, I have a property that's in disarray. There's a title issue. I may be suing. It's not on. I don't have a lender anymore. The lender went out of business. The loan was sold. I have an assignment. This insurer's records is erroneous. It's reporting that it's insured by Chase. Chase doesn't own my loan. I'm trying to insure my property and this particular insurance agency. And, again, the governing body for insurance agencies is the state insurance commission. They're not allowing me to indemnify or insure my property. And you need to call them and see what direction they may give you or try another insurance company and tell them I have no lien. They don't have any evidence that that lien was paid off or anything else. So you say, listen, I want some insurance. Or do you have a lien holder? No, I don't. I don't have any evidence of a lien holder. I need to insure my property. All right.
Oh, yeah, I understand. Everybody want to go through the game and saying, well, the public records say this. This is what it says on the computer and all that. You know,
sure.
But okay. But that answered my questions. But the last thing, real quick.
All right, brother.
Insurance company. When they put insurance on your property illegally, how do you go after them?
The state insurance commission.
The state insurance.
Because what's happening is that you have a debt collector who maybe paid pennies on the debt, maybe paid $10,000 or less for a $100,000 property, and they're committing insurance fraud by going and saying they're a lender. And if you get a copy of the insurance policy on there, they're saying they're a lien holder and a lender, and that is insurance fraud. You are not, and you should not be indemnified in the amount of $100,000 if we're using that as an example of a loan when you're a debt collector who paid less or hardly nothing for that. How can you be insured on something you not owed? So that is insurance fraud, period, cut blank. There's cases out there about that.
Okay,
well, but again, the insurance company is going to turn a blind eye because who's their best customer? The banks, the debt collector.
Right.
All right, brother?
Right.
I got to move on to the next call, brother. You can email me further. All right, thank you. All right, let's move on. 404, again, we have 2 minutes left to the live stream. Call in to get your questions answered. I'm going to continue going for another hour or less trying to get to all these callers' questions. So we're going to open up the line for 404-5021, 404-5021. You're on High Frequency Radio, Sharif Show. Do you have a question?
Hello,
5021.
Robert Sharif.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
How you doing, man? This is Jay in Georgia. I got a question for you. I'm going to try to make it short. I don't want to hold up the line like a lot of people have. My daughter, say, federal Stafford loan, what happened was her wages got garnished. I'm trying to find out how to stop that garnishment and how to – I already disputed the debt with a third-party debt collection company, but they have not stopped taking out this money in her check. So I'm trying to find out what way I need to go as far as attacking them, getting this garnishment stopped if I can, and getting this debt properly disputed.
Okay, so they're garnishing her based on the judgment they were able to obtain on a student loan?
That's what they say they're doing, but I know from a government loan they have to send in a form, I think it's a form SF-329, and we asked them to send us a copy of that. We've also asked Walgreens, the company that she works for, what did they get to allow them to start garnishing her wages. They won't send any documents. And neither will the third-party debt collector who's getting this money out of her, who Walgreens is sending the money from her check to them based on a quote-unquote judgment that they got against her.
Okay. Well, I mean, they're supposed to provide you. The FDCPA says specifically that they are, when you dispute a debt under 1692G, they must provide a copy. They must provide verification or validation from original creditor, the name and address, or if the debt has been reduced to a judgment, a copy of the judgment. So if they don't provide that to you, you have some liability. They have liability under the FDCPA, and you can sue them on that. Now, if they're doing a garnishment, the employer probably got a copy of a judgment, they should provide that to you, because if they're taking your wages, then they should provide you with the documentation that was provided them. They don't know if they got a judgment in error or a judgment fraudulently. Your human resource department should say, listen, you got a judgment, and this is what they gave us, and we're going to start garnishing your wages. If not, the only thing that's going to stop a garnishment, brother, is a bankruptcy. Okay.
Okay.
And,
yeah, well,
she's
like 23. I don't want her to go through a bankruptcy just to stop that garnishment.
But you don't
want
to continue to have
how
her
to,
wages
you know,
garnished.
It's only $12,000 student loan, and, you know, I don't want to ruin her financial life based on that. But, you know, I just
well, brother,
want to see
I mean,
how
with
I
a
can
garnishment,
go about
what, yeah, with a garnishment on, you know, minimum wages such as Walgreens, if she's on that minimum wage standard, you know, that garnishment is absolutely going to kill, you know, her economic ability to provide a living for herself. So I know a bankruptcy is not something you want to do. Either you want to pay it off, or you want to go ahead and see if you can get that judgment set aside after you determine what court it happened and whether you were served properly, whether due process and procedure was followed in obtaining that judgment. That's the only other alternative, is for you to find out that information, do a BK if it's just $12,000, or you know, make a payment arrangement with them, depending on who obtained that judgment and who's doing the garnishment. So you just
yeah, that's
to,
what
you
I'm
know,
trying to find
out.
I'm trying to find out who
yeah.
obtained that judgment and how did they obtain it.
Right.
I know
well,
for a fact that they sent the, as far as if they did get it through judicial procedures, the address that they sent it to was not the address that she even has on their loan application. So she never received anything
well, that's what
saying,
saying
that they were going
that's
to even initiate
right.
this
you
type of garnishment against her. Because, like I said,
right.
on her on the federal Stafford loan paperwork, it has the correct address, and they never sent anything to that address.
Okay. Well, again, that's why I say you need to look into, you know, look into that county where she was living, or the address on that paperwork, or an address which she lived. And if you have that address, which I'm sure you do as your child, you need to go ahead and look in that county, look in the county courts within that jurisdiction, and try to see if you can find that judgment. And it's going to be filed somewhere. Or you need to call that person and send them a debt validation dispute and tell them that if I don't receive that information, I am going to sue. I was never served with any court procedures or court papers for a lawsuit in order for you to obtain such a judgment. So unless you respond to me, you need to go ahead and sue them in small claims court or sue them in federal court for not validating or verifying that debt or giving you a copy of the debt that was reduced to judgment. Until you do that, brother, or bankruptcy, those garnishment is going to proceed.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you, brother. Peace. All right, let's go to the next caller, 8724-562-8724-562-8724. You're on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question?
Yeah, peace. This is Nick in L.A.
Peace, Nick.
Where we at? Real quick, you said give them notice either by mail or electronic. Did you mean email?
No, I didn't mention electronic. You know, you want to send all notices, certified mail, registered mail, FedEx, or something of that nature. You always want to have proof that you sent out any correspondence to anybody.
Okay. Another one real quick. When you get a garnishment on your wages, isn't your employer supposed to give you notice that there's a garnishment?
Normally, human resources should, and normally they will say, look, we received this documentation, you know, in order to begin garnishing your wage, and we're going to start garnishing those wages come next week or come your next pay period. Yeah, you should have an opportunity to, because you might want to look into it. I mean, you might not have had any idea about that garnishment, or you might want to file a bankruptcy to ward off such garnishment. That might put you in a very serious economic strain. So, yeah, they should communicate with you. Now, what you can also find with employers is just because somebody faxed you a judgment, what kind of research, okay, and vetting is that employer doing to make sure that garnishment, that judgment is even real, authentic, okay, or whether it's,
yeah.
it's absolutely, you know, or whether it's just, they don't. So, you know, if it was me, an employer would be stupid to pull a move like that on me, because I'll be like, listen, I mean, before you start taking somebody's check, you need to have your legal department make sure that, you know, the information you're receiving
in order to take, confiscate, or seize someone's check, you got to make sure, you know, it's airtight.
Yeah, because your employer is acting as a debt collector, right?
Not necessarily. I mean, they're in compliance with law. If they're sent a lawful judgment and a legal judgment by a competent court of jurisdiction, then, you know, yeah, they have to go ahead and proceed because they're a statutory entity. They have to proceed with the garnishment if the court has determined that you are liable in some way. So they're doing their job, but, you know, I'm sure they don't, you know, dot their I's and cross their T's, but I think that some sort of notice should be given to you prior to, you know, you just showing up and thinking you got your rent money or your car note money, and you show up and it's a surprise, you know, you've been garnished and $300 of your $500 a week is gone to some unknown debt collector and you didn't give me warning. I would think that there's a cause of action there against the employer for just not even giving me notice, all right?
Okay. All right, one more real quick. Like the other brother had, this may be a little bit outside of the scope, but the interfering with a police investigation and they start a court case or whatever on you, can you handle that like a debt collection?
No.
No?
The FDCPA
okay.
doesn't apply to any governmental agency, state okay. agency, or things like that. That's not necessarily a debt. That's a criminal matter, and no, you're not going to be successful treating it that way.
All right, man. Thanks, honors to you, and glad that you're on the High Frequency family, man. Thank you.
Thank you, brother. Honors to you, too. Appreciate it. All right, let's go to the next call of 443-8082, 443-8082. You're on High Frequency Radio. Welcome to the Sharif Show. Do you have a question?
Brother Sharif, can you hear me?
I can hear you, brother.
How you doing, brother?
I'm doing good.
This is Brother AJ from Baltimore, Maryland.
All right,
yeah,
Baltimore in the house.
Yeah, I had a couple of questions, but I'm just going to ask one question to keep it short. I just recently sent a QWR to Bank of America NA, which is my service provider, and I have not they received this on December the 9th, and I know that they were.
Let me hold you one. I just want to correct you, or possibly correct you, and I don't know, because I don't have any documentation. Usually Bank of America NA, which is the National Banking Association, is normally like the servicer. Bank of America's subsidiary arm is BAC Home Loans, and normally they're the servicer. Bank of America NA, just as well as of any other national association banking institution, is normally going to play the role of a creditor or alleged. So just make sure you know the difference. Is I see a lot of people get tricked up. You'll have BAC loans sending you something, and then you have Bank of America suing you. Or then you'll have a debt collector saying that you got a card through Discover Bank, but then, you know, they're suing you on the Discover card. So it's very important to understand these bankings and what role they're playing. But I've never seen Bank of America NA do a servicing. Their servicing arm is BAC Home Loans. But I may be wrong.
Okay, and so the reason why I stated that was because they assumed my loan from Countrywide, and they also their behavior, based on what you have said in the past, their behavior kind of indicates that they are a servicer and not the owner of the loan, because they keep constantly trying to get me to refi my loan, and also they just recently sent me a letter basically stating that they are the debt collector.
The servicer is always going to be a debt collector. Servicers are debt collectors because they're collecting on behalf of the alleged creditor or someone else. So they're always going to put that notation in their documents, or at least they should. Servicer almost always will do that, and they should, and if they don't, you should be suing them. But, yes, they're a servicer. But who are they servicing the loan for?
Okay, they are servicing the loan originated with Hamilton National Bank, which is in Pennsylvania. They then sold it to Countrywide, and as you know, Countrywide went out of business because of their illegal activities and so forth, and they were assumed by Bank of America.
Sure. So you more than likely got a securitized loan if it went to Countrywide, because Countrywide didn't keep any of their loans. They securitized almost all of them. Hamilton Bank is no longer in business. Okay, they're gone. They're dead. So you got a securitized loan, and you need to ask specific questions. Was this loan ever securitized, sold into the secondary market? Are you the creditor? When did you become the creditor? Provide me with a full accounting of the alleged account and a full chain of title to determine how you became the creditor from Hamilton Bank. And those are the questions you need to ask in the form of a debt validation dispute, and or you can include, you know, 12 U.S.C. 2605, a qualified written request under RESPA. But, you know, be careful how you address them, because they're going to play like they are a creditor under 12 U.S.C. 2605 under the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act. You want to, again, park them in the lane you feel that they're in based on your knowledge, based on your documentation you have, based on the fact that they acquired the debt while it was in default, and you want to say, well, you're not entitled to a QWR because you're not a creditor. So I'm going to send you this debt validation dispute, which really covers the same thing. There are two different ways to communicate with either a creditor or a debt collector and obtain the same information. So I'm asking you as a debt collector, because I've determined that you are a debt collector and you are not subject to a QWR, so I'm not going to give you a QWR because I've identified who you are. So this is what I need. You're saying you're a creditor. I'm saying you're a debt collector. Provide me with documentation that proves you're a creditor. Or under the FDCPA, provide me with a full chain of title, a complete accounting of information and payments and debits or whatever, you know, from the inception of the alleged loan, a full chain of title, to determine how we're doing from Hamilton all the way up to you, and tell me whether the loan has ever been sold into the secondary market via securitization, and tell me how you got authorization from Countrywide when they were dead, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, okay? Those are the specific questions, not 20 questions, not 30 questions. You should have no more than less than 10 questions, all right, in a FDCPA dispute. Okay, again, you want to communicate with them under the law that they obviously come under, which is a debt collector, because by mere reference of the letter you said, you put on the bottom, this is a attempt to collect a debt, and Bank of America or Bank of BAC Home Loans is a debt collector. Okay, great. So I'm communicating with you under the FDCPA. Why would you send a QWR to somebody that notates their correspondence and Dunning letter with you that says we are a debt collector, and you send them a QWR? That's like a Mexican saying I'm Mexican and you talking to them in Russian. So if they tell you if they say, well, I'm working for the creditor, be like, okay, well, ask the creditor, since you say you work for, information, and let me determine whether they really are a creditor. And if they are, then I'll send something to you to give to the creditor in the form of a QWR. But right now, from your letter, you're saying you're a debt collector, and right now I'm looking at all of you as debt collectors, and I'm going to communicate with you under 15 U.S.C. 1692 ETAL. Got it?
Yeah, so let me say this, Brother Sharif. So I've already sent the letter, and I sent the letter after I received a letter from them stating that they were actually a debt collector. And so I sent my letter based on the premise that I anticipating paying off my alleged mortgage. And so I'm sending them this letter in order to gather specific information. And my letter is based on the RESPA Act 12 U.S.C. 2605, as you just stated. And so some of the things I'm asking for, and I'm going to go through all of them, of course, basically a certified, true and accurate copy of the original promissory note and security instrument.
Alleged. Yes. Again, brother, you got to be, and I know you say yes, but that's what I'm trying to teach everybody, that your language and how you say things and how you, digest information, how you process is going to be very important. Because, again, the first thing we do when somebody sends us a letter is that, who are you? I don't know what you're talking about until I know what you're talking about. So when you say, send me a certified copy of the promissory note, what promissory note? You shouldn't even be there yet because you haven't identified who you're talking to. You already know from the letter that you're talking to a debt collector, so why are you asking for a copy of a promissory note when the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau said all they got is spreadsheets? You don't ask for a note. I don't want that. If I'm determined that I'm dealing with a creditor, then a creditor under 12 U.S.C. 2605E, the RESPA, would be required to get this kind of communication. I need a correct copy of the original promissory, alleged original promissory note. I need a full chain of title. I need a full accounting, and I need this information here. Anything about escrow escrow account, any forced place insurance you may have provided. You see what I mean? Once you realize you're dealing with a creditor, but when you send them a QWR, they're like, woo, we got another one. You know, he thinks we're a creditor. And we said in the letter, clearly on the bottom, that we're a debt collector, and he's sending us creditor-related stuff, so he believes we're a creditor. Sure, we're sending you a copy, a certified copy of the front and back of the promissory note. You're not going to get it. You're not going to get it because they don't have it. And a debt collector doesn't have anything but spreadsheets or maybe some publicly filed documents that's been in there for years, but that's not anything. You see where I'm going, brother? Always playing dumb. Okay, always doing the Columbo on them. Like, I'm lost. I'm like, I'm not understanding. Like, you're sending me mortgage documents that's recorded, but, you know, can you make me understand why you sit here? You're a debt collector in your letter. So I'm confused, and I'm a least sophisticated consumer. So make me understand, like, what role are you playing? Because you're basically playing both sides. And because you're playing both sides, a cause of a damage to you, okay, and a cause of action is the consumer was confused by this correspondence. And that confusion caused the consumer not to pay any payments whatsoever. That is a cause of action. I've sued for that reason. I was confused by this correspondence. It says that they are debt collector, then it says they're a creditor, then they're sending me this, they're sending me that. You follow what I'm saying? That's intentional infliction of emotional distress. Okay, because I don't understand what the hell you're talking about. You're telling me one thing in this page, and the next page you're saying that. I send you an FDCPA, you send me something that's required of a qualified written request. But you have to make sure you're not confusing that. Stay in your lane, brother. Stay in the FDCPA, and don't be sending them a QWR. You're not going to get a certified copy front and back of the note. You know that. You're not going to get anything else but some spreadsheets, and I already told you that. And everybody on this call has received the same thing. You haven't received one thing from a debt collector or even alleged creditor that shows you anything other than what's filed in a public county recorder's office or documents you already have in your possession. Not one. If anybody's on the line, dial one right now and tell me what information or what admissible evidence you got other than what you already have.
Okay. So, and my last question, Sharif, and you know, so basically, have I played myself out of position, or I mean, do I still
No. You were confused, but you did kind of admit that you had a mortgage because you said, okay. All right, you're a creditor here. Here's this QWR. Send me a copy of the note. You already admitted that a note exists. That was based on a deception. They're going to presume that you have a mortgage. So let's presume, okay? And I'm always going to play dumb like I don't have one, but, you know, the court is going to know, yeah, you got a mortgage. We all know you got a goddamn loan. Now, they don't need to prove the loan, but we ain't going to dispute that you got a goddamn loan. Okay, well, Judge, I got a loan, but that doesn't mean that I owe them the loan. They have to prove that I owe them. So, no, you're not out of position. This is a learning experience. You just got to say, you know what, I sent you a QWR, but I did a research of the documentation and realized that you acquired this alleged loan while it was in default. So you're a debt collector. I'm going to send you this debt validation dispute instead, and I will communicate with you pursuant to the 15 U.S.C. 1692 until it's been determined otherwise. Simple as that.
Okay, got you. Thanks, bro.
All right, brother. Thank you. Peace, man. Thanks for calling. All right, let's go to 843 down in South Kakalaki. 843-6534. You're on High Frequency Radio. Welcome to Sharif Show. Do you have a question?
Yes, it's a bright and sunny day here in South Carolina. This is Queen Mother.
What part are you in? How
I'm
you
in
doing?
Georgetown.
You in Georgetown?
I'm
all right.
Georgetown. Yeah.
I love Charleston, Columbia. I used to be out there, dated some people out in Columbia and Charleston. That's the part I like, in Myrtle Beach.
I'm in between Myrtle Beach and Charleston.
All right,
so
beautiful. What's your question today?
On your way to Myrtle Beach. Okay.
Oh,
all
right. Beautiful.
I'm thinking about relocating back to Atlanta, so I'm going to have to rent. So I spoke to this guy, and he told me that he's in the process of he already got a divorce. If not, they own the home, and he's trying to get it just into his name. And he said once he do that, I guess he got to go to the bank and get it in his name, and then he'll be able to, well, he said he could rent me the property out, but I just wanted to know what type of process, how long is that, is it going to affect me, you know, a little bit down the long run and renting the property? Is this a scam or could it be a slow?
Okay, so you say you got a gentleman that has a, you have a gentleman that has a property in Georgia. You want to move back down there. Is it a foreclosed property that he's going to get ownership of and he's doing some other things and he's going to make you a tenant?
He's going to make me a tenant, but him and his wife is mortgaging.
Divorcing.
Or,
okay.
Yeah. They divorced. Both of their names are on it. And so
okay.
I guess since he don't want the property no more, he's going to just put it in his name. So I don't know how long that's going
to
take.
Yeah, I would be careful
my,
with that, sister, for two reasons. I would be careful with that. If you have a couple that's breaking up and an imminent divorce is to follow and, you know,
mm-hmm.
she's saying, okay, I'm leaving, you know, you can have the house, it's not going to go down like that because then a divorce is going to be determined who's going to have liability or responsibility for the house. He may get it. But, you know, at any rate, you'll be protected as a tenant even if it was to go into foreclosure under the tenant protection law. Okay, that's the Obama law that when he came into office, it's called the Protecting Tenants at Foreclosure Act, and it's the tenant protection law. What that law
mm-hmm.
says is that if you are a lease tenant based on an at-arm's length transaction, meaning that you know, you're not related, and you know, it's no funny business there. You're a true tenant,
okay.
and you're renting from a person that's you're just doing business with pretty much. And
yeah.
even if that person was not paying their mortgage and a subsequent foreclosure took place and you have a lease, you are able to stay into that property, but you would have to pay, whether it's
mm-hmm.
a bank or anybody else, you would have to pay that bank market value rent or whatever is on your lease agreement, as long as that lease agreement is consistent with the market value of rent, and you can't be kicked out. Now, that law ends December 2014, and
mm-hmm.
it says also that you have to be careful of, let's say that property went to foreclosure, and a person like myself or Yousef bought it, and we intended to use that property for our private residence, okay, for personal
mm-hmm.
residence. Then we don't have to respect that law. We can go ahead and evict you pursuant to whatever the state eviction laws and time frames are. So just get you a lease. Make sure it's a good lease. You know, try to get
mm-hmm.
you a 2-3 year lease just in case some foreclosure or something happens, just in case he doesn't get the property, she gets the property. And, you know, that may provide you some protection under the Tenant Protection Act.
Okay, because he's saying that I guess he's going to get some money out of the house, and he's going to pay off the mortgage. I remember he saying something about paying off the mortgage and giving her cut.
Yeah. Well, this is what I would do, sister. I would go ahead and get the address, go to the county recorders, look up the property in his name, and see what kind
mm-hmm.
of documents exist in there. See if you see any notices
of
default. Yeah, see, well, you know, in Georgia is a non-judicial state, so you're really not you'll be able to see something in there that would give you an
uh-huh.
indication that the property's in foreclosure. But it's a touchy situation because, you know, let's say the wife changes her mind and you know, she's gone, she decides to come back, or the court gives her, you know, out of the home, and she can come out of there. Now you're in the middle of something. You know, and if he's talking about taking out a loan and paying it off, I don't know if too many properties, unless he owns it outright or he has a good bit of equity. If he had any equity, I'm sure it's been diminished by the real estate collapse. But,
you know, you got to do your due diligence. You know, just don't take
uh-huh.
his word for it. Go ahead and search the property record, see if you can see anything in it, or ask him. Say, listen, is the property in foreclosure? Are you in default? You know, when is your divorce taking place?
Yeah, I was going to refer him to, you know, listening to the show. And he was like, no, I got everything. You know, I'm just going to go down tomorrow, which is today. And he said him and his wife is going to go down to the bank and just get it. I guess she's going to sign off her name of being, you know, responsible or whatever.
Yeah, that's not
going to
happen. The only thing he can do is buy her out. I mean, she can quit claim the property, her half over to him. But I'm sure whenever they decide to get a divorce, you know, counsel for either one of them is going to go ahead and be like, okay, well, you know, we're going to go ahead and we want the property, or she's going to ask for the property. You know, the lawyers are going to muddy the water and make this as big of a contest as they possibly could. So, sister, I would say just be careful. You know, do your due diligence.
Yeah.
Keep something in the waiting just in case you have to move, but get a solid lease. Make sure it's notarized. Make sure you put some disclaimer in there that, you know, the property is not in foreclosure and there's no default, no imminent foreclosure on the horizon, and that, you know, just do some due diligence and move forward in that fashion.
Peace and love, you babe.
Peace
Thank
and
you.
Love, mother. Thank you. Have
I
a good day.
Floor.
All right, let's go to 813-1886. You're on High Frequency Radio. Go ahead and turn your radio down. And do you have a question today?
Yeah, peace, God. This is Rashid from Florida here.
Hi, Rashid.
About,
what's up in Florida, man? My favorite place, man. What you doing down in Florida? Man, you just got me all excited, man. I love Florida.
Yeah, man, it's awesome down here, brother. The mortgage situation here is the situation
it's
is
hard,
bad.
Brother. It's
yeah,
hard.
It's hard, brother.
It's good that it's judicial. But it's hard, man, because Florida now, them courts, them banks, the government have told them courts in Florida, you need to clean up this foreclosure docket or we're going to start cutting your damn money we giving you to the courts. Y'all got all this crap going on. Florida is just turned damn mob style. They like, look, we doing foreclosures in 30 days. If you ain't got no defense, we issuing an order granting foreclosure, and they're moving on. Florida was one of the pioneer states. They had some of the best people that wanted to protect your constitutionally protected rights and right to property, but you know a lot of that has fizzled and faded, and now Florida is just becoming we taking your shit state. Okay, we just taking your shit.
Yeah,
we don't
that,
hear
that, that and that's exactly what it's looking like too.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
There's one mortgage they basically received an assignment before default. You know, but the original lender is someone else, and then now from my understanding, appears to be a servicer since they received an assignment, even if it was before default. Is that correct?
They can get an assignment before default, and then that would not subject them to the FDCPA, depending on how that assignment was written and whether it was a MRSA assignment, which you know you can challenge and not need the FDCPA. So it all depends on what that assignment says, whether the note and the mortgage was assigned. You still have plenty to go on, even if, you know, they did receive the alleged loan while it was not in default. So, you know, you got a judicial state there, brother. Listen, when somebody have to come after you and make the case with me or any of my students or any of my listeners that's listened to me more than once, that should be quite difficult to do. You should be able to go to their ass in Florida and just do the best you could to utilize the court, use your appellate process, use your interlocutory appeals, use everything you got in the court, man, to keep it up in the air, tie it up, put it into the appellate court, and if you have to, go on up to the Supreme Court, but just make a good defense at your property.
True, yeah, that's what's up.
While they're doing the foreclosure, go ahead and do you a parallel case suing them in the district court for wrongful foreclosure, violation of the FDCPA. Florida has some pretty good consumer protection laws to where I have a lot of students down in Florida that are used to small claims court, and you can go to their ass in small claims court because they got some pretty good laws, and you can just keep going after them in small claims court until the statute of limitations has expired, and then you'll be good. I have a lot of students down there that do that. You know, they just keep that small claims going. Every time they send you a letter, you just go on and change the date and take them up to small claims court and be like, I need another $100, $500, $1,000, whatever I can get, and keep piling up those orders until they're not going to stop, okay? But until you get to the point where the statute of limitations is gone. And then and then when you finish with that, just go on and step up and do your FDCPA claims out in the federal court. And Florida's a good place for those. I mean, I have a lot of people in Florida that's doing well with that, and you can win that way. In the courts down there, judicially, again, deny, 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 affidavit, I never received a loan from this particular entity or even the entity they claim I did, you know, motion to dismiss, okay, you know, things like that. Counterclaims is probably going to get a dismiss. Don't do that. Just go ahead and start your own new federal case for wrongful foreclosure, FDCPA, FCRA, and the Florida Consumer Protection Laws. Or leave those out.
Okay, so you're saying don't do no counterclaim then?
Don't do no counterclaim
in the state
court. Counterclaims, they're always going to dismiss. Yeah, they play games with the counterclaims. Just don't even waste time with it.
True that. Now, also, now, if so-called alleged lender or debt collector, creditor, what have we, tries to file a foreclosure, but the statute of limitation has already ran out. You file a motion to dismiss and file a notice for a hearing, to request hearing, but they ignore everything. I guess they basically just want to pull out of court since they don't want to give a hearing or answer any requests, sent emails and paper trail notices as well. And then the alleged creditor or debt collector starts calling, trying to get modifications and indicating that I'll be hearing from a different alleged creditor by the beginning of next year. So basically the statute of limitations has already ran out for them to try to enforce it. So it's like y'all are in direct violation, or they're basically considered debt collectors from here out. Is that correct?
Well, statute of limitation has nothing to do with the debt collector, because a creditor has statute of limitation, so it doesn't matter. Statute of limitations continue to toll. If you're past the statute of limitations and they're trying to, so you'd be like, listen, you're prohibited and barred by statute of limitations. You're estoppled, okay?
Right.
So you have – so basically, you know, I don't know who you are, but even if you had a legitimate debt, you're not able to use the court system to collect that particular debt, so the case needs to be dismissed. Just
so
on that
basically
basis,
sending them a stop communication, not a letter.
Well, if you're in a judicial foreclosure in the state of Florida, you would just do that in the form of a motion to dismiss.
Right, we filed a motion to dismiss, but they don't want to answer it or uphold the motion. Don't want to send us a motion granted or anything. They just acting like they went into retard mode.
A motion to dismiss, they don't have to answer. The court's just going to decide whether we're going to grant your motion to dismiss, or is it going to be sustained, or is it going to be denied. And more than likely, just prepare for it to be denied. Okay? But if it's
right.
statute of limitations, you can look into an interlocutory appeal, you know, saying that, look, I mean, the statute of limitations has clearly been expired, so they can't bring this action in court. You know, they haven't invoked the subject matter jurisdiction of this court. The statute of limitation has expired, you know, and their documents support that. So, you know, you just go based on that, and if the court doesn't want to listen, you know, you consider an interlocutory appeal, or, you know, go ahead and build you up a case of FDCPA and then get you a lawyer, you know, because on the FDCPA it allows for attorney fees for the prevailing party. So you can look into that.
Okay, so the FDCPA is enforceable against a creditor as well then, or no?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
It applies to creditor depending on how the creditor is handling that debt. It always references a creditor and a debt collector. A creditor, and I tell everybody all the time, a creditor is subject to the FDCPA depending on how they behave in collection of that debt. But they are subject to it as well. It's not just for debt collectors.
Okay.
So if they're collecting in a name other than themselves, and if they're, you know, they're given the insinuation that they're somebody else is collecting that debt, then they're subject to the FDCPA.
Okay.
If they're a true creditor and they're doing what they're supposed to do, and you send them a QWR and they don't respond to it, then you sue them under creditor type laws, which is 12 U.S.C. 2605, the RESPA, TILA, the Dodd-Frank Act, 15 U.S.C. 1641G, and whatever have you. Those are for creditors, okay? So you don't want to sue a debt collector under a creditor statute. You don't want to sue a creditor statute under a debt collector statute. You have to identify and know within yourself who they are. Don't let them tell you. You have to determine who they are.
Okay, so now with that being said, the creditor, even if the original lender assigned it to a different bank before default, that bank receiving that assignment, they're still considered the creditor, right?
All depends, brother. You know, all depends on what kind of trip your alleged loan took. You know, they could assign it while it was current, but that assignment could have certain defects, okay, material defects in it that subjects that particular instrument to be void or voidable. It all depends. I can't say that because they got the loan while you were paying your payments on time that you're paying the proper party still. You know, you could have been current, and it could have been sold into the secondary market via securitization, and you could be paying Bank of America, but Bank of America don't own the loan. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So you got to research
yeah.
your loan and see what path it took and determine whether, one, they're a debt collector or creditor, and two, whether you're paying the appropriate and proper party. And it's your responsibility. You know, even in the state of Georgia, the Supreme Court said it's your responsibility as a mortgagor to determine
mm-hmm.
whether you are paying the proper entity. That's your responsibility. So if you paid this lender 15 years and you sit up and say, man, I shouldn't have been paying, but they sent you some documentation that gave you an indication that they may not have been the proper creditor, and you paid them 15 years, oh, well, you out of luck. It's your responsibility.
Okay.
It's your responsibility to govern your creditors and govern your government and govern your, you know, you promise me on and
right.
on and on and on and on. All right?
Yeah, so you're going to initialize it basically alleging that they are a debt collector, and you're going to send them a list of questions to verify who they are. And once you get that, then you can know how to respond to them accordingly.
That's right. But I would always be safely and say, you're a debt collector. And they
right.
may come back and say, we ain't no debt collector. What you talking about? We got
yeah.
your loan while it was
right.
current. What the hell are you talking about, boy? You better switch over
yeah.
to this 12 USC, send us a QWR, and we can talk. You understand?
Yeah,
If you say something to me in Spanish, I'm going to be like, brother, I don't know what I do. I look Dominican, but I'm English, man, so talk to me in English. You keep talking to me in Spanish, I'm going to ignore you, and I ain't going to know what the hell you talking about. You follow what I mean? So that's how you
yes,
do it,
sir.
Brother. You just always start off as a debt collector and let them prove. Said, listen, I understand you say you got the assignment while I was current, but until I get a full chain of title and a complete auditing of the alleged account, okay, and I determine that you legitimately obtained some alleged loan and you paid for that loan, which most assignments does not determine that they paid for anything. It'll say for valuable
right.
consideration, what is valuable
yeah.
consideration, what you gave them a drink, you know, what you get,
right.
what you get them a strip, what you get them a stripper in the club, and that's how you got the loan.
Exactly.
What did you pay for?
Exactly.
You can't have a financial injury until you can prove to me you paid some consideration for the alleged loan
that's
you
right.
say that I owe. Okay?
True. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Now, last
because
thing.
If the lender
last
gave,
thing,
if
sorry.
Lender, if the alleged lender gave you that loan and you gave him some chickens and some roosters and two cows, I could have gave you that and paid off my own
yep.
house. So what
that's
makes
right.
you gives you the right to get some chickens or to get a favor on the side and you get that loan and I didn't get it? I'm the one been paying the taxes, upkeeping the property, you know, paying the payments and everything else. How are you gonna get a benefit that exceeds the benefit that I may be able to receive?
Right. Right. So now the last thing, bro, the clarity on the servicer. Now, is the servicer an actual creditor or the debt collector? That's another big thing, the servicer. Who are they? Because you can't find a clarification of who the servicer is in the Fair Debt Collection Practice Act or nowhere really besides Title 12 indicates that the loan servicer. But it doesn't clarify.
Well, a servicer is very vaguely mentioned even in a security deed, a deed of trust, or a mortgage. It mentions them, I believe, in all the thousands that I've read, maybe just one area it mentions a servicer. So a servicer really can be anybody. Like I tell you, you know, debt collectors are posing as servicers. What is the requirement
right.
of a servicer?
So
well, if you're in New York, you actually have to go through a vetting process, and the state has to license you as a servicer, okay? So, you know, a servicer is very vague. A servicer can be a debt collector, and they will say in their communication that they're a debt collector. A servicer will always be a debt collector. Unless they're a servicer, your loan is in current, okay, and they were the original bank and servicer who initiated that loan, then they wouldn't be a debt collector. So you just have to look for the indication. The indication is what's the cue. This is an attempt to collect the deck, and any information used will be used for that purpose. We are a deck collector.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's your cue. That's your cue. When you see that, you should say, Brother Sharif, all right, let me turn to the show and let me see how I need to handle that, because that's
right.
The indication that they will give you. All right, brother?
All right, that's what's up, bro. Appreciate it,
all
bro.
All right, man, keep it shiny in Florida, brother. Enjoy that down there. What's the degrees down there?
Man, it's the wind chill will hit us about a good 50 or 60, and then the sun come out. And then when the sun go down, it, you know, it's getting cold again.
Oh, wow.
Right
all
now
right,
it's
brother.
70 degrees right now.
Oh, that's good. Well,
below,
that's what I wanted to know.
70,
I'll take that. I'll take that.
Yeah. Yeah, with the sun out, and then it got a good chill breeze coming through. So it's pretty decent right now.
Beautiful, brother. Be blessed, man. Take care. Thanks for calling.
No doubt.
All right, let's go to 504-0376, 504-0376. I'm sorry, you're on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a
How
question?
You doing? Yes, sir. How you doing there, Brother Yusuf?
I'm Brother Sharif. I'm not Brother Yusuf.
Sharif. I'm sorry. Brother Sharif.
That's all right.
I'm sorry. My bad.
Okay.
I literally found out last night that my house is being foreclosed on the 4th.
Your office? Wife, commercial property?
My house. No, my house where I live at.
Oh, your house. Okay. All right. Go ahead.
Yeah. And I just found out my wife's kind of going through a depression thing, and I lost my mother earlier this year, so I wasn't really up on everything.
All right. Sorry to hear that, brother. My condolences. Go ahead.
Thank you. I know when we first got along with Countrywide, they sold it to Bank of America. Then about 2 years ago, my wife wanted to do a loan modification. I found out that she was doing it after she did it. So we had to come up with like $18,000 because they denied it. Then we got Nation Store, and she's going through a little depressive stage, and she hadn't been paying a note. And a friend called me and told me, look, man, they foreclosing on your house on the 4th. So what's my – should I just try to pay it up, just try to catch it up, or what? I don't know.
What
don't know
state
what
are you in?
I'm in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Okay, is it a judicial or non-judicial state? I don't remember.
I think it's a judicial state, if I'm not
I
mistaken.
Believe it is, too. All right, so – now, when you said someone told you that they're foreclosing on a particular day, have you been served with a summons and complaint?
I don't know, because I'm at work, and my old lady's at home, you know. And I asked her, she said she couldn't find the letter, and I don't want to pressure her because she's...
I understand, but it's time to have a real talk with the wife and just say, hey, listen, baby, you know, I need you to snap out of it for a few minutes. I need to know what's going on so I can defend our property, because we can't be depressed living on a bus. So I need you to wake up for a minute and give me this information and tell me what I need to do in order to defend our property, because you're going to become more depressed if we're sitting out on the street. So, you know, if you're going through a judicial foreclosure, you had to be served by a process server, or you can be served by certified mail, FedEx, regarding if you're a natural person and the property is in a natural person's name, regarding a summons and complaint on a foreclosure. Now, if you're in a non-judicial state, he could have found that information that you're being foreclosed on off of some website, off the county recorder, or you know, of a trustee or something of that nature. So you need to find out when the foreclosure is going on, who's doing the foreclosure, and you need to definitely defend that action, you know, aggressively.
Yeah.
But without
yeah.
knowing who, what, when, and where, I don't know how to direct you.
Well, she did tell me, I said, well, how much you normally when they foreclose, they say you got to pay this amount of money or something, right?
You have a – but I wouldn't, brother, I wouldn't be getting up $18,000 to pay somebody that I don't know if I owe. You
well,
can pay 18, you can pay far less. You can pay far less than 18 – you what?
I paid that because she did – for the loan modification, she tried to do a couple
you paid
years
what?
Ago and it didn't – I had to come back and pay – you know, they tell you to stop paying your mortgage on the loan modification when she tried that. And they denied her. I found out after they denied her, I didn't know she was doing it. So I had to come out of my pocket with $18,000 to save my house.
So you paid them $18,000 years ago?
I had to pay 18, yeah, 2 years ago. I had to pay $18,000.
Oh, brother, I'm sorry. I'm sorry to hear that. I really am sorry to hear that, because that's some money you could have spent a third of that and just gather some information or hired you an attorney to kind of put things in perspective. But more than likely – you probably paid a debt collector $18,000, and since they feel you're willing to do that, they're going to now swoop up and take your house and your money. So, brother, you need some more information, and, you know, you can contact me on the email address, thelawmaster44@yahoo.com. Once you gather your documents, talk with the wife, and gather some information about what you did, what you didn't do, who's coming after you, and all that. It's hard for me to gear you or navigate you into a particular avenue, and you don't have that information. So, you know, try to get that information. Come on the show next Tuesday or email me, and we can see if we can figure out, you know, what we need to do, discern what course of action needs to be taken.
All right, I'll try to get that information. Can I go to the courthouse and get it if the lawyer's suing me or something, you know, put in a judgment?
If you got a lawyer suing you, yes. You know, that's okay. Where you can get it from. But, you know, it sounds like the wife might have some information. And you know, if you're living in a house with her, you know she can't hide it but so many places. You should be rumbling through her file and see what, you know, what she got if she's not able to point you to it. All right, brother.
Thanks.
Appreciate you calling. Good luck. All right. We're going to try to get the rest of these calls. I think I got 15 minutes left here before we are knocked out. I'm going to go to 214-4665, 214-4665. You on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a quick question?
I do, Brother Sharif. What's going on, man?
What's going on, Brother Peace?
Peace. I just want to have a quick question. I know a lot of things are usually relating to mortgages and whatnot, and my question kind of alluded to what the sister called in relating to renting. And I don't know how much of a correlation everything does relate or if it does have too much or if they're, you know, totally just contrasting as far as, you know, renting and the mortgage, even though it is a contractual obligation. So if you just could touch on that briefly, and that's pretty much all I had.
Okay, explain to me a little bit more, brother. So you said renting and a mortgage. You mean as far as, you know, when you default on an alleged loan or mortgage that you become a renter by operation of the default. Is that what you're speaking of?
Well, just I understand that portion of it, but no, I'm not in mortgaging as of yet. I'm just trying to kind of get a better understanding of the correlation of that. Also, just with just renting out or just, I guess, signing a tenant agreement, I guess you can say. Like, how would some of those same remedies be afforded, you know, with the, you know, the fair debt collection, or would some of the same remedies be afforded, you know, with some of the other things that that you've mentioned pertaining to the renter's aspect versus just, you know, the mortgaging or the foreclosure remedies, if
right.
That makes
well,
a little more sense.
A little bit, but I'm going to try to answer it the way I believe you're giving it. If you're a tenant, no, I mean, courts have determined that landlords, pending, okay, whether you have a management company involved, can be subject to the FDCPA, just like a creditor would. A landlord would be considered a creditor, but they can be subject to the FDCPA depending on how they go to collect that rent or anything else. No, you can't sue
right.
A lender under the FDCPA if they're trying to evict you because if they're evicting you, you're just a tenant. You don't have ownership in the property, so that would be different if that's what you're asking. But if you have but this is what I would do as a strategy. Let's say you're renting from a landlord and he fails to pay his rent and they're trying to evict you under that, then I would send out an FDCPA letter to them and say, how do I owe you rent? Or, you know, or something of that nature, and kind of do that. But that's a little bit more difficult and something that takes a little bit more experience and knowledge to be able to maneuver into that position.
Right.
But renters, you know, if you're a legitimate renter or if you are owner and then you don't make your payments and your deed or whatever instrumentation you have or the security deed of trust or mortgage says that by operation of that agreement, any breaches will basically transform you from owner to tenant and you're going to be treated as such, you know, when you go down to a summary court for eviction. So, yeah, the document says that, but who's entitled to enforce that document? Okay,
correct.
And that's what you have to look at. That's going to be your defense. Did I kind of answer your question?
You did, and I kind of wanted to see how you would go into that. Now, as far as a particular situation that kind of does piggyback off of that, which what you were saying also is, now, I know how it does work with property taxes as well. Just give you kind of case and example of the property that we're on right now. Just say, last time I checked, they were actually behind on their property tax. So if I would go ahead and, you know,
pay those property taxes. I know it's a little bit different here in Texas as far as, you know, the deeds and whatnot, but if I would go ahead and take those property taxes, and I would now be the holder or, you know, the rightful person to, I can't say it properly, I don't know the proper terminology, but I guess I would be the creditor in that sense because I have paid that debt that's owed via these property taxes. So that would put me in a different position to kind of utilize some of the procedures that we're talking about because now I would be, like I said, in a sense, that creditor because now the original lender or the original person who is behind on the property tax, now that I've assumed that and through the deed of record or through the county clerk or whatnot, wouldn't they kind of, you know, change the position? Yeah, does that make sense? Do you follow what I'm saying?
You know, if you're doing a tax purchase, you know, a tax certificate purchase, that's not going to make you a creditor. Yeah, you're buying it from a tax sale, then that would make you. Yeah, I mean, you're going to be entitled to the property if the homeowner doesn't pay you back interest and fees.
Correct.
The cost of the tax. Yeah, that would put you into sort of a creditor status, and you have to understand that that's what the banks do. You know, the banks are the biggest participants in tax sales because they know when your property's going to tax sale, they know if you paid your taxes, usually when they take your property over, they're the ones that pay tax, so they might be like, okay, if you beat me up on the foreclosure, I'm going to go ahead and not pay your taxes, and I'm going to buy the property at the tax sale. But this is why I say we have to start investing back, putting that money back into our home and investing in defending, hiring an attorney, hiring a paralegal or a consulting group, and paying your own taxes so these banks can't get flippy and start doing maneuvers on you because they do that. They be like, okay, well, we can't, statute of limitations is gone on the foreclosure, so we can't really see foreclosure, but he ain't paid his taxes, so we're going to, by now it's about 15 grand, you know, and if you're smart, you've saved some money, but most of us didn't. We're living good, okay, we bought a new car instead of paying our taxes and paying our homeowners insurance. So, you know, that's one of the things that you need to look into. All right, brother? I hope that answers your question. I'm going to move on. I'm going to try to get these last few in before the last 10 minutes is up. All right, let's go to 770-770 down in the state of Georgia, 9898, 770-9898. Give me a quick question right quick. Welcome to High Frequency
Brother
Radio.
Brother Sharif, peace.
Yes, sir. Peace.
Hey, I appreciate all your information. I know it's a lot of work you have to do and Youssef to put this together to make it sound
brother,
when
y'all appreciate
speak. I know it's a lot of work. All right, I spoke to you last Tuesday about going from Bank of America N.A. with the alleged mortgage over to PennyMac. I went and did my homework assignment you gave me. I went down and pulled a security deed from the court of records. And as of October, last payment I made was October. And it's as of October the 3rd, it says it has been unassigned. And when I was looking at the paperwork, it doesn't show anybody holding the security deed now. It was transferred on the 1st. And also it says here from the paperwork from Bank of America N.A., you are hereby notified the server of your mortgage loan that is right to collect payments from you will be assigned, sold, or transferred from Bank of America N.A. to PennyMac Services LLC effective January the 1st. And when I got one phone call, no paperwork, one phone call from PennyMac, and the first thing they said that this was a debt collection. So I need to know next how do I – right.
Yeah, you need to send them a debt validation issue. So you're a debt collector. You're purporting to own a debt that I have no personal first-hand knowledge of. I'm asking that you send me X, Y, and Z to prove that you are a creditor and who you're acting for, name and address, telephone number of who the alleged creditor is, a full accounting, okay, of the alleged debt you report that I owe, and a full chain of title of the alleged debt. Now, I didn't say I owed you a debt. I didn't say I did get a debt. I didn't say I got a loan. I just said, look, I need some more identification from you to determine
Correct.
Who you are because I don't have any first-hand knowledge of anybody such as your name and you know, and that's what you want to ask for. So that's the first thing you want to ask for. Get a response. They're going to probably send you a copy of your security deed. But, you know, that's where you want to start. And once you get that response, go ahead and email me the response.
I sent you one last night.
Okay. Oh, you did? Okay. Well, then we need to look at that and talk further and see what their response was and what kind of response you should give back to them.
All right. Okay, so don't even call them. Just send them a letter.
No, don't call them and don't take no calls from them. Yeah,
cool.
That's what I need to know.
You're the teacher. You're the professor. And I'm one of the students. I'm here to learn.
That's right. No, you don't want to answer nothing. You just want to do all the asking, okay? And you want to get them to give answers. And when you got enough answers to be able to formulate or be able to identify who they are, then you roll on and say, okay, well, I determined that they are legitimate creditors. Let me send my QWR. Or you might say, well, you know, I don't have enough proof or admissible evidence to determine that I owe you a debt. And until I'm able to determine that, until you provide additional documentation, I want you to cease and desist all collection activities. And that's as simple as that. In other words, don't talk to me no more until you can give me something as a least sophisticated consumer that will determine that you are owed a debt and what you've sent me don't determine that.
Okay,
in order for me to pay you, I got to feel that I owe you.
Correct. Right, because we're not trying to get out of pay nobody. We don't want nobody trying to take some money from us that we don't owe them either.
That's right. I don't want to pay the wrong person. I don't recognize this debt. I don't recognize you. So, you know, I need to determine who you are, and you haven't given me enough information for me to make that determination. All right,
now, if I go back to your first webinar or your second webinar, can I get, like, some information on how to write that letter? Or you contact me after the show or when you get time?
Yes, just email me after the show, and I'll give you information regarding that.
All right, I appreciate it. Everything. Once again, I know it takes a lot of work.
All right, let's try to get in there. I got 5 minutes left. Let's see if we can go to 316-7288, 316-7288. Do you have a quick question?
Hello. Yes, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay. Once you've been in a traffic court situation and you've said you understand, is there any way to go in there by certified letter or file something through the clerk, not the clerk court, but the clerk of the court and redact any contract with him?
Yes, sir. Sorry to interrupt you, but this is not a traffic show. You'll have to call in tomorrow at 11 o'clock same time and speak to Brother Youssef or Brother Savage. They'll definitely be able to address those type of questions. This show is about debt and debt collection and mortgage issues.
Okay. Well,
all right. But I appreciate you calling in.
I have a quick debt collection question as well. I had a Discover Card Bank issue a judgment, and I didn't show up for the hearing, and I dismissed it. And last fall, they started withdrawing money out of my checking account without any sort of notification. Is there any way to go back on those old cases?
You need to do a Rule 60B motion, Federal Rules Civil Procedure, Rule 60B motion to set aside, or look into your local rules and see what process or procedure you need to invoke to be able to set aside a wrongful judgment. But you didn't dismiss it, because if you would have dismissed it, then they wouldn't have got a judgment and a garnishment. Okay, but you need to look that up and go back to that court and set it aside for failure due process or failure to serve or whatever you deem was your defense against that summary judgment or judgment being placed against you. Okay?
Okay. Okay, thank you.
All right, appreciate you calling. I got a few minutes left. I'm going to try to get to the last two callers right quick. We're going to go to 240-4179. Let's keep your questions real short. I got one more calling, and I was able to get to everybody who had a question today, so I'm going to try to accomplish that goal. But 4179, you're on the air. What's your question?
How you doing, Brother Shanice? I have a garnishment that's coming from a second mortgage company. They gave me a writ a couple of years ago, and I didn't get a chance to go to court and defend myself. They actually sold my mortgage to another company that's coming after me, saying you owe me money. They sold the loan to us, but they got a judgment and they sold the loan. Can they do that?
Well, I don't. You know, that's a good question. I don't know if you can sell a judgment. I guess you could. I mean, it's a judgment. I guess you can sell any type of debt.
No, but they didn't sell the judgment. They sold the loan to another mortgage company, and I'm paying them.
So you said you got a judgment against you, and they're garnishing you, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So if you got a judgment against you, and they're garnishing you, then you know who got the judgment against you. What's the name of the company?
Landmark Financial.
Okay. Did you borrow money from Landmark Financial?
Yeah, a couple of years ago.
Okay. From Landmark Financial?